It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Lori Gill joins Jason Snell and Dan Morin, Apple experts all. We're going to talk about the most important transition in computing in years, the Apple move to Apple Silicon. This is an all-Apple show. So if you don't care, maybe you should skip to next week, because that's what we're going to talk about, and there is a lot to say. Stay tuned. Twit is next. This Week in Tech comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure they are by making access and authentication seamless. Whether they're working in the office or remotely, visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 777, recorded Sunday, June 28th, 2020. Apple's risky move. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Roman. Skip the waiting room and awkward face-to-face. Get ED medication conveniently delivered to your door in discreet, unmarked packaging. Go to GetRoman.com/twit for a free online visit and free two-day shipping. And by ExtraHop. ExtraHop helps you keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Get tips on securing and supporting remote access or check out the full product demo at extrahop.com/twit. And by Zendesk. Zendesk is a service-first CRM company that builds software designed to improve customer relationships. Right now, Zendesk is offering a complimentary 6-month remote support bundle that comes with the essential tools your team needs to stay agile. And it takes hours, not weeks, to get up and running. Go to Zendesk.com/twit to get started. And by LastPass. Prepare for the unexpected in your business with LastPass, trusted by over 17 million users and 61,000 businesses worldwide. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. And there really is only one story this week, and that might explain the illustrious panel we have assembled. From MacBreak Weekly, Lori Gill is here, managing editor at iMore.com. And it's always a joy to see Lori. Hi, Lori.
Hi, it's great to see you. It's good to be here on a Sunday.
Hope you're not talked out. We just did this on Tuesday. We're going to do it again on
Tuesday. I can never talk enough. It's so exciting.
Okay. I'm really excited. This show, I've been waiting for this show all week. Also here, Jason Snell from SixColors.com, my personal Mac guru. Hello, Jason.
It's great to be here. I'm sad I can't be up in the studio with you, but you know, 2020.
I was thinking that. It's like, God, when usually Jason would be here, and we've been preparing for COVID for 15 years at Twit, so we can do our shows like this, but I do miss it, meeting and seeing people in the flesh once in a while.
Now I don't have to trust Comcast to stay up during the whole show in person.
Good luck with that. Also with us, your colleague from Six Colors, Dan Morin, also prolific podcaster in his own right. The two of you could do more podcasts than I do together, I would say. I know that's a lot. That's a lot.
Only so many hours in the week, let me tell you.
Dan is also, I didn't know this, but you're a novelist too.
That's true.
Yeah. In fact, John loves your novels.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind.
The Galactic Cold War series.
I'll hold up a couple because they happen to be, of course, they just happen to be on my desk, you know, conveniently. So,
you know, I've seen those and I didn't put, I'm such an idiot, two and two together that's you. Oh, that Dan Me. Morin.
Different hat, but same words.
How much of your day do you spend writing fiction?
It really depends on whether or not I've got a project sort of running. I try to do it in the morning for a few hours. But, you know, if I'm under deadline or something, obviously I spend a lot more time doing it if I've got like a book under contract. But I try to keep my hand in and do it at least for a couple hours in the morning when I get up and I'm nice and fresh before I remember where we are and what's happening.
I hate writing so damn much, but I realize that it's only a matter of time before I will have to give this microphone up and start writing. So I'm trying to write every day just on my secret block just to get in the habit.
It's like working out. You have to do it.
You have to keep that muscle going, I think. Yeah. You're all writers. Yeah. I wrote a post about it saying, my problem is I'm used to the most primitive form of communication. My brain thinks it, my mouth spits it into a microphone, and then it's done, and it's over, and I can walk away. It's pathetic. There's no thought involved. So
you're really talking yourself up there, Leo.
Writing is so hard. You have to think about it. You have to edit it. It's so much work. I really,
you know, transcription technology has really improved. Maybe you should just speak into the microphone and then just have somebody edit those words and post them.
Yeah, I tried that once. Did not work.
Yeah, it's not the same, is it? It isn't.
You got to do it by hand. But it is definitely hand. I've been looking forward to this show because I think, and you know, the timing is good because we got nothing else to do. This might be the most important week in computing in this century for sure. Perhaps, I don't know, perhaps, I can't think of another time with even the Mac transition to Intel, I don't think was this important. And of course, what I'm talking about is the Worldwide Developers Conference. Kicked off on Monday, was going all week. I'm sure that's all you guys have been doing all week long, which is why you're here to fill me in. I did watch the keynote and the State of the Union, which is the more techie kind of follow-up they did on Monday. We even streamed both of those with commentary. And then I've been reading incessantly ever since, even to the point where I downloaded Xcode, the Xcode beta, picked up, I think I started the Stanford CS193 course in iOS development. And started to dig into Swift UI because I think we are going to enter a new era of computing. And here's my, and you tell me, you guys could talk me down and say I'm full of it. But my thesis is we certainly began a new era of computing in 2007 when the iPhone came out. We didn't know it at the time, but that was going to transform computing. All of a sudden, the vast bulk of computing is now done on a thing that's in your pocket. It's always connected to the internet. It's omnipresent. Social media, Facebook and Twitter began on the desktop, but really wouldn't be as powerful as they are without the smartphone. That transformed everything. And Apple became, as a result, the most valuable company in the history of the world, now worth close to $1.5 trillion. They have hundreds of billions of dollars of cash. They're a behemoth, a juggernaut. The iPad, which had a lot of promise 10 years ago, didn't really seem to take off. But what I think I didn't fully appreciate, I'm sure you guys did, but what I didn't fully appreciate is that from day one of the iPhone coming out, Apple was preparing for something different. And certainly once they realized how successful the iPad was, Apple started preparing with their own chips. They started moving to technologies like metal. They started to do a lot of things that's really accelerated over the last couple of years with things like Catalyst to move into a new world of computing, an ecosystem they could utterly dominate. And that with the announcement that they were going to finally abandon an architecture that's been around since the 70s, x86, and move to Apple Silicon, this was the, for me, the piece that went, oh, click, and the whole thing seemed to come clear to me. We're in a transformational moment. Am I nuts, Dan Morin?
No, not at all. I think this is a big deal from the perspective because, I mean, the iPhone in the earliest days, they were still sort of figuring out where it was. But once they started rolling out their own processors, I think it was only a matter of time. And increasingly in the last several years, as they put their own processors in like the Apple TV and the HomePod and the Apple Watch, you started to step back and say, why isn't this in the Mac? Why is the Mac now the only device they make that is running on somebody else's processor when they have done all this amazing work? Because we would keep seeing when the phones came out, you know, they'd be benchmarking them and these things would be off the charts and you'd be comparing them against laptops and you'd be like, why this chip in a phone is outpacing this laptop that costs twice as much and is supposedly like this really powerful device they make. Why can't they bring that ability over to the Mac side as well? And I think Apple has shown time after time that they love controlling the whole hardware, the software, everything, the whole device, because they can optimize it to do exactly what they need it to do. And I think that it is fundamentally a huge change, obviously, for the Mac, but it really only solidifies something that we've seen with the iPhone and the iPad over the last decade or so. And, you know, famously, I think they, you know, originally started out wanting to build something like the iPad, and the iPhone ended up being kind of a diversion along the way, which is, you know, of course, hilarious because it's a huge, huge portion of their money now. But yeah, I think that now that they're putting everything they run on their own custom silicon, I think we've just dipped our toe into what is going to be an enormous change for the Mac. And that's saying something for a platform that's undergone so many transitions in its history.
I think it speaks a lot to not just the future of Mac, but the future of computing in general, because if Apple is going to be doing, if they're going to be competing in this space, in this processor chip space, Intel has to do something to match that so that PCs can build, you know, into the future as well. And this could also really just be a huge improvement for Microsoft and, you know, all the other chip makers, all the other processor manufacturers out there to like step up your game, because now Apple's in the business too. So you don't get to just sit back and be the kings of this realm because somebody's coming to take your throne, you know?
What happens to Intel, Jason? Is it curtains?
I really do wonder about that. You know, it's not necessarily a fait accompli that, you know, Intel will need to step up its game. We've seen Microsoft experimenting with Windows on ARM processors repeatedly. They're back there again now. And, you know, maybe it's definitely possible. If I was Microsoft, I'd be looking at this and thinking, I want to do what Apple did.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not, you know, with Qualcomm, let's say, uh-huh, or somebody like that. Like, why don't we redefine this and get away from Intel? Because Intel isn't doing, you know, Intel isn't working for us either. So I do think it's really hard. This is, you know, the lesson that Steve Jobs learned and then put in Apple's culture from a very early point is don't rely on other people for your critical business infrastructure. And, you know, Intel was a convenient tool for Apple to get out of the PowerPC Alliance and get computers that were actually running at decent speeds when the PowerPC Alliance was lagging. But, you know, the iPhone, because it wasn't a computer, they got to rewrite the rules. They ended up developing their own processors for it. And, you know, they've been thinking all this time, you know, what if we could apply this to the Mac? What if we could get away entirely from being on, you know, because I would wager that a lot of people's frustration with Apple's release schedule for a lot of their Macs the last decade has been because Apple was waiting for Intel.
You bet.
And
you bet.
Intel has had a really bad decade. So this is like the logical, I think, conclusion of what Apple learned from the iPhone, which is, you know, they built essentially the best chip design group in the world. And why would they not press their advantage? And I now suspect that the last two or three years of sort of static Mac development is because Apple's been too busy redesigning their next wave of Macs when they can control all of the parts.
Yeah, I mean, I've been depressed about the Mac for years. Maybe that's why I'm so giddy now, because it's very clear Apple had not abandoned the Mac. You know, they made noises, oh, we love the Mac. But this shows a lot of love because... And incidentally, transfers to the Mac a lot of the glow from the iPhone, because mm-hmm. now you have an ecosystem that's, and this was, I thought, one of the most important little footnotes of the whole announcement, iOS apps will run unmodified on the new Macintosh. That means you have one of the most powerful ecosystems extant. It suddenly takes you from a 10% market share for macOS to almost equivalent competitor to Windows. You've got more than a billion devices running compatible operating systems on compatible chips. Dan, why didn't they do this sooner?
Well, it's funny too, because they dropped it in that announcement. It was almost, it felt like an aside, right? It was like an
That's
hour
no
and 45
aside.
Minutes in.
That's
oh, the
most important part of the whole damn thing, in my opinion.
I you know, I was taking notes and I had to like almost stop and run the video
what?
Back and be like, I'm sorry, what did they say?
What?
Yeah, I think this is huge, right? I mean, they didn't do it sooner because fundamentally it just wasn't going to work, right? Like trying to figure out how to run these types of apps on the Intel architecture was going to be a pain. It was going to be an emulation and it was going to lose the experience. So it's neither going to perform well, nor was it going to be a great way to use those apps on a device that is fundamentally not set up for that touch input. But between the ability to use the same silicon architecture and the fact that they have been rolling out keyboard and cursor support via like the Magic Keyboard and rolling that into iOS 13 earlier this year means that there's a lot less excuse around not being able to run those apps and have them run well. And I, you know, I think several of us think there's also probably another shoe left to drop there in terms of, well, you're porting over all these touch primary apps to your device that does not have touch on
it. Yeah, what happens there?
Interesting question. And does it mean that they might finally decide, well, you know what, the Mac can have touch too. It's never going to be the primary interface, but it's going to be something that's available as an option.
Yeah, why not?
Exactly. So it might make the, it's hard to imagine them putting those apps there and saying, you'll have a great experience with just your keyboard and trackpad like any other Mac app, because it's fundamentally, those apps are not going to be designed for that.
It also changes my perspective on Catalyst. Because, I mean, I don't think alone. It all looked like, it's just a layer so that you can kind of weekly put your stock app on the Macintosh. Now, Catalyst has a completely different role, and Apple alluded to this. That's, you know, your app already runs on the Mac. That's if you want to make it even more Mac-ish, you can turn on the Catalyst framework, and now it's a full-fledged Mac app.
It's like, and it adds good, some dimension.
Go ahead, Jason.
For sure. It adds some dimension to the idea of, we've been talking about Catalyst, and their pitch was always make a good iPad app and then bring it over to the Mac with Catalyst. If you look at some of the changes in iPadOS 14 that they announced, like drop-down menus and sidebars,
it's gone both ways.
Strangely similar to Mac features, right? And I think that's the kind of holistic view that they want people to take is, look, if you make a good iPad app, you're going to add these features, at which point it's a better Mac app. And then if you want to make it even better, you add Catalyst. Also, my understanding is that by essentially exporting a bunch of stuff from iOS and iPadOS in order to make Catalyst work, they were essentially laying the groundwork for bringing over all the other stuff that makes all the apps work. So it was kind of a work in progress. But yeah, their goal here is sort of multi-part, right? It's they want existing Mac apps to survive. They want all of the iPadOS stuff to run on the Mac as well. And then in the long term, you will use SwiftUI and Swift or whatever, and you'll write things that can run across all of Apple's platforms. But in the short term, we've talked about wanting an iPadOS laptop for a while. A lot of people have written about that. And I had that moment, just like Dan did, where I thought, it's a MacBook is the iPadOS laptop, especially if they have touch, because as of, when they ship these first laptops with the Apple Silicon, they'll have all those iPad apps on that Mac. Plus, it'll be a Mac on top of it, which is kind of mind blowing.
What do you say to people, Lori, who are scared if somebody in the chat room, that's it for Unix. That's it for the command line. That's it for the Mac. It's the Mac is going to become more and more like an iPad. Do you see it that way?
No. In fact, I think Craig Federighi, when he was interviewed, I can't remember which one.
He was on the talk show with Gruber.
Was it the talk show?
He did Marques Brownlee.
Yeah, it was one of those where he talked about the fact that this right here, what we're looking at, it is evidence that the Mac is not going to be an iPad. There are some things, like right now, for example, they don't have anything planned to offer boot camp as an option that
I thought that was really interesting. My initial reaction was that's a licensing agreement because Microsoft does not license Windows on ARM to OEMs, right? So it's a
license.
Not yet.
I believe that
or it's OEM Microsoft only, right?
That's what I mean. It's you have to make a machine based on it.
Right. Yeah. Right. So like right now, for example, the licensing is not there, but that's a thing that, a lot of people, or actually not a lot of people, a certain portion of people want boot camp. They're going to say, well, if I can't have boot camp, I don't want an ARM Mac.
Federighi said, you're not going to need it because it'll run on a VM almost bare metal speed. So you don't care.
Which some people are going to say that's not true. I do care, and I'm not getting an ARM Mac. And those people, for them, that's what the Intel Mac is for. Because someday when all of the Mac line is on Apple Silicon, that's going to be a point where either boot camp is back on Mac, or everyone will have realized, that was silly of me to think that boot camp was the only way to have Windows on a Mac, because virtualization really is actually better. It comes from this idea of you know, 10 years ago, I was, you know, computing was like this. 5 years ago, software was like this. And my brain is still thinking That's about right. the past and not looking to the future. So I'm already scared of right. losing these things that were, you know, 10 years ago, they were bad, but not realizing that that's actually changed at this point.
I kind of want
or
Apple.
Maybe not today, but soon.
I kind of want Apple to dump boot camp. That's a, who cares?
I've never actually used boot camp. So, you know, for me, that's not an issue. I use a VMware, you know, yeah. virtual machines yeah. to do it. Yeah. But there are people who they feel very strongly that boot camp is the only way to do it, that virtual machines just don't do it as well. They have a lag or something like that. There are people that feel that way. So I think the key here for Apple would be to prove to them that a virtual machine is as good as or better than bootcamp. And the only way they can do that is by providing the kind of software experiencing the speed and the processor that's needed to do this kind of thing, to have people go, oh, that's silly. Why was I such a stickler for this one feature when actually that's not really an issue? So,
or I'm sure that Apple also has numbers on how many people actually use bootcamp, right? Like, is exactly. this a big enough portion small. Of our market that we care
Apple's
about it?
Funny, though, because, I mean, how many pro users are there? There are some users that, because of their nature, you want to support, even if it's a fraction of your audience. Sure. And bootcamp might be that, because it's used by DevOps, sysadmins. It's the kind of thing that might be an audience you want to keep. You want them buying Macs. Just as,
we're in a very different world. Like when the Mac Intel split happened, or Mac Intel switch happened, we were in an era where I feel like there was much more demand. People wanted to switch to the Mac, but they couldn't do it because they needed Windows. They felt they needed Windows.
Right.
But
That's
today,
changed.
not only do we have Windows in like screen sharing environments, basically, where you can kind of have Windows on demand if you really want it, not for games, but for like apps and stuff. It's a very different world. I would not put it past Microsoft, honestly, that at some point here in the next couple of years that they make available a version of Windows on ARM that runs on Apple Silicon. It would not surprise me at all. It's just not there today.
If I were them, I would do that. Yeah,
exactly. And the Mac, I think it's so easy to look at Apple and the power it holds over its platform and say, well, they're going to completely lock it down because look at iOS. But I think the right way to look at the Mac on Apple Silicon, and they've shown this again and again now, is it's where the restrictions don't apply as severely. So there is Unix under the hood. There is the terminal. You can compile software. You can download things. You know, you're going to be able to download software on those Macs from just random places on the web and run them just like you can on Intel Macs. They're not locking any of that down. So
They'd
I think that's
foolish.
The right way to look at it.
They would be foolish to because as small as that audience is, those are developers. Those are the people you really want to keep in the fold.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the secrets to Apple's success has been how quickly developers jumped on the Mac bandwagon because they had a command line, because they had Unix. That was a big part of the success of OS X.
Plus, it provides sort of a release valve, too, for all the people who do think that the iPad OS and iOS is too locked down. It's like, well, you still got the Mac, and now you'll even be able to run those applications, right? Like, it provides them a place to go, where it's like, you can complain about how locked down this is, but, you know, we still provide this other option where you can get all your Unix software, you can download software from anywhere, go nuts, right? Like, that's, you're a small part of the audience, but here is the solution for you, essentially.
Well, that's kind of my point with the ecosystem. Apple now has, I mean, it starts with the watch, the TV, the phone, the tablet, the computer. They can make an ecosystem that's completely interoperable, completely compatible, that builds one on the other. The synergy is mind-boggling. And the other thing I would point out, and it's probably coincidental, but Microsoft decided to close all Microsoft stores forever this week. And maybe it's a coincidence. I'm not sure it is. Microsoft's been making interesting moves. We talked a lot about Apple on Windows Weekly, for instance, this week, because ever since Satya Nadella took over Microsoft almost 6 years ago, it's become very clear that he is not a believer in a company powered by Windows and Office, which was what he inherited. He believes in the cloud. And increasingly, he's been saying things like, we want to be wherever our customers are. Their support for the iPad is actually for Office was actually better. That was the best touch first version of Office, much better
Absolutely.
Than on the Surface. So I think honestly, Microsoft's looking at this saying, yeah, we're going to leave x86 behind too, because it's a dead ancient dead platform. We need to do that. We didn't have, we couldn't do that because we are so tied in legacy. We would have been slaughtered. But thank you. Thank you, Apple. They were certainly part of the announcement. Office is already running on ARM, on Apple Silicon. And I think Microsoft's just going to say, yeah, really, our business is services in the cloud, and we don't care what you're using. And they're not, I don't think they're tied to Windows particularly. Or
feels very like IBM, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, too.
Yeah.
Same transition.
Yeah. I think Windows for them, somebody's saying in the chat room, is a legacy product line. Office is not. And that's why I wasn't at all surprised to see them developing Office for Apple Silicon.
Yeah, well, Windows, I mean, I people talk to me a lot about the whole argument of, Apple says you can't do touch and on a desktop OS, and Microsoft says you can, and who's right and who's wrong. And the truth is they're both coming at it from opposite directions, headed for the same point in the center, which is this converged device that can do touch and all of that. But the reason that Microsoft has been struggling here is because Windows, all the power of Windows is in its existence as a legacy product. And it is there because everybody has Windows, but it makes it very hard for Microsoft to do anything with it other than maintain it. So yeah, if I were Satya Nadella, it would be like, you know, again, it's very profitable. It's very successful. It's also an albatross.
Yes.
So how do you deal with that?
Yes.
And when you look at what Apple did, Apple could have, and I would argue maybe a few years ago, did view the Mac the same way. And I think Apple finally decided they were going to bring the Mac forward, which was going to require it to change because they weren't going to make it a legacy platform, and that would anger some people, and it has, but that they were going to push it forward. And, you know, Microsoft, I sometimes think, is just going to realize that the people who are there because they've been on Windows for 20 years is not a growth business for them, and they don't want to support that anymore.
Well, where they're going to push them, and I think it's pretty clear, and it's the right way to go. We have, you know, we have Macs everywhere except the business office where they're using Windows. It's to thin clients. There's no reason they should be running powerful computers on x86 chips. They just need something. It's QuickBooks went through this transition. A lot of people were running QuickBooks on-prem, on the hard drive with a computer. But at some point, they start using QuickBooks in the cloud, and then it doesn't matter what. You could use a Chromebook. You could use an Apple. You could use a Windows. And I think that's what Microsoft figures business is going to do over the next 5 to 10 years. There's no – it doesn't make sense. It's a really a nightmare just with ransomware and everything else for a business to be running computing power on the desktop.
Well, like 15 years ago when the Intel transition happened, everybody was like, oh, good, I can run my dentist office software or my whatever Windows software on it, right? Yeah. But I think about it today, and I think that stuff – isn't going cross-platform. That stuff is going to the cloud. And once it's in the cloud, it doesn't matter what
doesn't
computer.
Matter.
And I know that there's still legacy software out there, but it's not going to matter because everybody is going to convert that service into the cloud because then it can run everywhere on all devices, and that's better.
So maybe Windows embedded is the future. I don't know. Right?
Well, the flip side to that, too, is just the sheer number of apps, as we discussed before, on the iOS and iPadOS platforms as well, right? There's a lot of these things that also exist there. And by opening that up, you start to have a lot more things where it's like, well, maybe this runs on an iPad. You know, if I were still allowed in coffee shops, every coffee shop around here that I used to go into had like an iPad or a tablet POS. You know, you go to the register
and they
check you out with that. Like more stuff is moving in that direction, too, because that's where sort of the hot development is. So and again, you could run all the cloud stuff on those oftentimes as well. So I think that the focus is shifting away from these ideas of certainly not having like your old. I used to work in IT and deploy, you know, your monitor, your CRT monitor and your tower next to it and your keyboard and your mouse. And you're like, this is expensive. It's a lot of equipment to maintain. It's just not where things are anymore.
Yeah, it's overkill, too.
So for business, I can see this, what you're saying, all making sense. But my question is, what about PC gaming, though? That's where I think that is not something that's going to the cloud. And Mac has so far not really been very successful with you know, like the real gaming community on Mac, it's definitely a PC thing. So how does Windows continue to support, how does Microsoft continue to support PC gaming, not console gaming, but PC gaming?
I don't think it's
going away entirely.
Look at the PS5 and the Xbox Series X, the new gaming consoles, by the way, both running on ARM platforms. Look at Stadia and the cloud gaming services, Microsoft's X Cloud, Microsoft's all in on xCloud.
Did you realize this was a WWDC session? I know Dan wrote about it this week. Apple now has full keyboard and mouse support on the iPad for games, kind of wild, but there are lots of other places to play games, and I get that you can't play PC caliber games in the way you want right now, but I think it will be interesting to see whether we need gaming PCs in 5 years.
I think it's a niche. I think, honestly, the best corollary to me is like people working on classic cars. It's like your classic car still runs. You can still do it. Yeah. But most people don't want to invest that time. Most people just want a car that takes them from point A to point B. So it's not going to go away, but it's already a small market. And I think it's only going to get smaller as the consoles and mobile like basically squeeze it out.
Gamers are loud. And so... But I think about something like Fortnite, which was a PC game kind of platform, but is completely cross-platform at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that to succeed as a game, any gaming company at this point says, it's got to be on Windows. Do they?
I think what the issue is right now with PC gaming or with computer gaming is that PC gamers or computer gamers, they don't buy a Mac to game on. They buy a Windows computer to game on because of the ability of a Windows Mac versus the ability of a Windows versus Mac. So
that's mostly NVIDIA, by the way. It's 99% right. Because of the GPU. Mm-hmm. You can't get a video on Mac.
Exactly. So if Apple were to implement better, graphic processes and thing like that, that would definitely make a huge change.
What if suddenly the best GPUs are running on Apple Silicon? What if?
Yeah. Well,
now what do you do, gamer?
Apple has gotten serious about gaming. Like I think every 5 years or so, like they really used to push gaming on the Mac, and it never materializes is the thing. And I don't think fundamentally, I've thought they've always don't understand gaming as well as they understood some other things. Like when they, really made their play in music, they're like, Steve Jobs clearly was a music aficionado. They clearly understood the appeal of it and how to use it. I don't think Steve Jobs ever had time for games. I think that was something that interested him not at all. And I think that kind of filtered down through a lot of it. So it was never something they were really going to spend a lot of time on. But I agree, like the Mac as a gaming platform has always lagged behind the PC. But then the iPad comes out and the iPhone, and all of a sudden people are playing a lot more mobile games as well. So, the balance shifts a little bit. And again, I don't think that Apple's necessarily interested in replicating the PC gaming market, but it will be interesting to see once you can play iOS games on the Mac, how that's going to influence development and hardware and various, like where the gaming crowd is going.
I would imagine the casual iPad and iPhone style gaming is probably a bigger market than PC gaming. I would imagine.
I think that's right. I think that, but think about this though. If PC gaming was so big for a while, and then mobile devices came into our lives, and then mobile gaming has become this huge, is monster of the gaming world. But now, if we can play our mobile games on our Macs, there's going to be young people who are going to feel comfortable sitting in front of a computer playing games, not sitting on a phone playing games. Will that bring back desktop gaming, let's call it not PC gaming, but let's call it desktop gaming or laptop gaming? Will that cause like the gaming industry, game developers to start making, like really going, hitting down hard on making big games for computers? And, by then will Mac, just have a better reputation for being a good gaming Mac, because that's where all these kids are now gaming. They're using mobile games on their Macs that they could port over from their iPad. But maybe that's part of the key of just generally getting people to consider a Mac a gaming computer at some point.
There's this PC gaming enthusiast community, and I don't know how big it is, but it's very active and very loud, and we're very aware of them. And certainly all the successful esports are played on PCs. But I wonder if this community, if suddenly is looking over their shoulder and seeing that the Apple GPU is actually better than their, ray tracing NVIDIA GPU, if they wouldn't happily say, well, fine, then I'll put it on a on Apple Silicon. I don't have a problem with that.
There's no shame in saying, you know, PC gaming is a niche and Microsoft cares about it and the hardware makers care about it and it'll be filled. And it may go, it may continue and be fine. But PC gaming is one little part of Windows. Like the big business thing, which is not even a niche, it is huge. That's the part where it's going to kind of evaporate. And look, if there are different hardware companies and software companies that are keeping the PC gaming thing alive, then more power to them. I don't think anybody's saying, you know, PC gaming must die. But I do wonder if the trends in consoles and in mobile lead to a point where, you know, stuff doesn't get like canceled. Like PC gaming is not going to get canceled. What happens is people look at other things and then it goes away and nobody notices. That's how things, that's how old tech dies, right? It dies with a whimper. And I'm just saying, if you look at the trends, you've got to wonder, is there enough there to keep PC gaming at the forefront, or is it going to become less and less relevant until even the hardest core PC gamers have moved on to some other thing and it can just kind of fade away? I'm sure Satya Nadella wouldn't be too sad.
The current iPad Pro GPU, Apple claims to be equivalent to an Xbox One X. So they already have the equivalent of a high-end gaming console in their existing iPad.
So, and, yeah, and by the way, from 2018.
From
basically.
2018. And I have to say, by the way, this explains a lot about that, because the iPad seemed vastly overpowered for the tasks it was given. It was like, why did you put so much power in this thing? Now we understand it was going to be the development platform for a whole new generation of Apple Silicon computers, because that's basically what's in that development kit. I think
that and my understanding is that that's also what they've been at least broadly testing on inside Apple, is what is now going to be that development kit, which is that iPad 2018 iPad processor.
We don't know. They left out a lot of details. Like, we don't know these Apple Silicon, it probably won't even be called Apple Silicon. They'll have some name for
it. Some people, a very funny person on Twitter suggested that they call it the G6. Like, they just are picking up where they left off.
There's nothing inherently in ARM's RISC architecture that means it couldn't be every bit. It feels to, I mean, honestly, I don't know why people are so reluctant to say goodbye to x86. This is an antiquated change. Yeah.
Just change.
But it's such an antiquated platform. It was a horrible platform in the 80s.
Yeah, nobody ever thought, like, you know, it was widespread and it was cheap, more or less. But, like, it's not something that a lot of people were like, this is the best thing. I mean, even back in the PowerPC days, they were outspeeding it. But the architecture, I think, of the RISC chips versus the Intel chips,
so clean,
was not something that was like, this is better. They're like, no, it's good at these things and it's cheaper and it's everywhere.
Right. Yeah, better never won an argument in tech.
We'd all be using beta players. Still,
yeah,
right.
Better is not the argument. Compatibility, widespread availability, and cheapness is what kept the x86 architecture alive. Intel wanted to kill it. Let's not forget, they designed the Itanium. It was going to kill x86, except it failed. It got so hot, it melted. So x86 got a second life for another 20 years. I, for one, am not sad to say, see you later, x86. And if anybody could do a better job, better than Qualcomm, better than Exynos, it's Apple. I think, and this is, of course, not as yet to be proven, I think potentially even better than NVIDIA. Apple has a lot of brain power there.
Yeah, we'll see. And people should be skeptical, right? Until we see actual numbers from actual shipping Macs, not test kit Max, but shipping Max, people should be skeptical. I will, however, point out that if you look at the smartphone industry, Apple is so far ahead now that by the time the iPhone comes out in the fall, there's still no Android phone faster than the previous year's iPhone. They've essentially lapped the field on iPhone. And we know what the iPad is already like in 2018 was faster than more than 90% of the PC laptops sold. So, like, I think Apple is going to be super competitive, and we'll see, you know, in processor, probably in GPU. We'll see, because they're going to have to compete and they're going to be judged. But they are in a really advantageous position right now.
Yeah, you make a good point. We're talking about enthusiast matters that people care about as enthusiasts, but the real world isn't going to care about that so much. And Apple's going to win on the, they've already won. They've already won.
Yeah. I mean, more of the point. Like these are, we've seen what they can do with the chips. They fit in a phone and a right. tablet. Like when they have an entire desktop or laptop infrastructure that they can roll in, like those, they're not held back by as many constraints in terms of, you know, power or space or heat. Like all of those things have to be much more carefully managed in a phone than they do in a laptop or desktop. So the potential gains there are even higher. Again, Jason said, we've got to wait until we actually see these things and know what they can, what they're capable of. But, you know, this is like a little bit, it's a little bit like them fighting with one arm tied behind their back, right? Mm-hmm.
So let's not be a cheerleading squad. What could go wrong? Lori, what could go wrong?
They could turn their back on Mac and turn it into an iPad, which is what some people are afraid of. That's a thing that we could be afraid of. I know that they're.
I feel like
this saying is, right now.
This was where they said no. This is where they proved to me no, that they're not going to do that.
Right, but you know, and I agree with that. But they also said they were never going to make a tiny iPad, and they That's also true. Said they were never going to make a giant iPhone. So yeah. we like if we're talking about what potentially goes could go wrong, to me, that's probably the biggest fear that Mac users have right now. Not that the ARM chip won't be as good, you know, that they could just go back to Intel, no big deal. But that they will move forward and that they will actually eliminate Mac OS and replace it with iPad OS. That's probably the biggest thing that could go wrong.
In a way, the risk that they would make chips that wouldn't live up to the promise is not a problem because they already have made chips that live up to the promise, right? So in a way, they've proven they can do the chips, right?
I feel like hubris is their biggest risk right now, right? That they're going to say, oh, we're on top of the world. We dominate here. We have the freedom to make some decisions, and they're going to make some decisions that that go wrong. I feel like sometimes Apple, they're on top of the world in one level. And then when you're on top of the world, you are your own worst enemy because there's nobody else to be your worst enemy. And so like they haven't shown this, but what if they say, time to close it off so it's only the Mac App Store. Time to get rid of the command
line.
That
would be bad.
Time, right?
Yes.
But I don't think they're going to because they could have done it now and they didn't. But that, I think, the danger where we've seen it with some of these App Store controversies, right? Where they're their own worst enemy in pushing it too far, in allowing the bureaucracy or in their motivation to increase their services revenue to go against what their customers want. I think that there's some serious risk in there. I guess the other risk would be on the pro end, what can they do? They have not been asked to do a Mac Pro kind of product, which architecturally is very different from an iPhone, right?
Think
in a
how
way that
long
maybe a
it
little
took
laptop is.
For them to make the new Mac Pro after announcing it. It took them years. Mm-hmm. And that was on an architecture they already were working on.
Yeah. Although you got to know that Mac Pro was built with them knowing they're going to ARM. So I suspect there is a plan there of some sort.
In
but like
hindsight.
We haven't seen.
Right.
For the people who demand that kind of processor power, demand that kind of GPU power, slots, how do you do? Like there's so many things. And we only have hints. Like they changed the boot process in Mac OS. That's an interesting example where I wrote a whole article about
what happened there. I didn't hear about that.
Well, iOS and iPad OS they just boot onto the boot disk and that's it. And on the Mac, you can like hold down keys and you can do recovery and you can boot into a different thing. And they had to add all of that to the bootloader that previously didn't have to do that because it was the iPad and iPhone bootloader. And they did it. They added all of that functionality so that a Mac behaves like a Mac. It makes me wonder actually if one day you might be able to partition your iPad and have two different versions of iPad OS and choose which one you want to boot into. Developers would love that, but they've got it on the Mac. So I feel like they're making those right decisions. But you know, there's risk there. There is risk that they can't push. Like they're going to have to, let me put it this way. If you think about the Trashcan Mac Pro, which was kind of a failure because they made some bad bets on technology and where they thought technology was going, there is that question of like, what if they make a bet about the GPU and the slots and the other high-end processing needs that their pro customers want in video and in other places like that, and they think they can do it, and then they get there and they can't do it. That, I think, is a big risk. Not that they won't. I think that they probably have some great confidence there, but sometimes their confidence is misplaced, and they've never done it before when it comes to this architecture.
Yeah, when you get that big, right? I mean, I think Jason's right that being your own worst enemy is the biggest potential flaw there. It's sort of buying into your own hype, right? And that is certainly something that Apple has been accused of doing and demonstrated doing. We don't have to look much farther than the whole butterfly keyboard fiasco of the last few years to see that they are willing to make design decisions that they are absolutely confident is the best thing ever. And then it turns out maybe it's not. Maybe that was a bad decision. And when you're that big a company, it's like turning a battleship, right? Like you can't immediately just yank everything and change it back. You're selling millions upon millions of units. So they have a lot of risk in terms of making a bad decision that is multiplied by the scale they're working at and really is going to be hard to dig themselves out of if they do, in fact, make a bad decision somewhere along the line there. But yeah, I mean, once you've, you know, we used to look often at Apple in terms of its rivalries, like Apple versus IBM or Apple versus Microsoft or Apple versus Google. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think that Apple has kind of put itself in its own category, but that comes with a lot of risk because of that. Because when you're not fighting actively or defining yourself against your competitors, it means that you're not challenged as much necessarily. So you don't have to respond to them and say like, oh, they're doing this. We need to find a way to get better. We need to really like improve our edge. You get complacent. And that's a real risk, I think, with Apple here.
So I guess one question people are going to be asking, should you buy a Mac now? But this would be a bad time. Should you buy an Intel Mac?
Always in motion, the future is, I believe, a wise puppet once said. Yes. The truth is, any computer you buy is already going to be out of date, right?
Yeah,
drive it off the lot.
Yeah. Somebody asked me this week, Leo. They actually asked me this week, and I said, if you need it right now, then go ahead and buy it.
If you got a kid going to college. If your computer died,
I bought my daughter a new laptop this week.
You got her a 16-inch.
No, that was Greg Joswiak who
That's
did that.
Right.
I got
Jaws did
I
that,
was
yeah.
smart. I got her a MacBook Air.
Much smarter. 16-inch. If you had Jaws money, you might.
maybe. But this is my point is if you can wait, of course you should wait.
Yes.
Because on the other side of this is the new era for the next decade or more of the Mac. If you can wait, you should. But you're not gonna. It's not the end of the world if you buy a Mac this week.
They're gonna support it
for 5 years. Yeah,
for a
long time.
Years to come. That's at least two.
Well, they still have their obsolete
more than one.
Whatever they're required to do with vintage and obsolete hardware.
Is that seven years? I would imagine.
Yeah. It's five and then seven, before.
And if the transition lasts 2 years and it starts at the end of the year, that means it's going to be, they're not going to even have completed the transition until the end of 2022. And that means that in late 2022, you're still going to be able to buy an Intel Mac.
No.
That presumably is going to get support for two more years at least. So.
Stop.
Do not buy an Intel Mac if you can help it.
I remember, actually, I mean, look, I bought G4s or whatever at the end of the line. Those things felt antiquated almost instantly, right? I mean,
that was probably a bit of FOMO, you know, because here's the thing, though, is ARM, you know, who's going to buy the first ARM Mac is the other question. The other side of that same question is, so if it's just, you know, your best friend or your cousin or your, you know, your mom or whatever, should I wait and buy an ARM Mac? My question is, well, I don't know. Do you really want to be the first person to have an Apple Silicon Mac? So maybe an Intel Mac is the right choice for people right now. Maybe they want the last Intel Mac because maybe Apple Silicon isn't going to be totally ready, and it might be great for us because we're always on, you know, the cutting edge and we're getting things even though they don't really quite work right. They're definitely a first iteration. I wouldn't put one of my friends through that, though. I would say, let me buy that one first. Let me tell you how good it works. And then, you know, a year later, then you can get into that one, you know.
Dumb people like us are buying the first one. That's the answer.
Yes.
I'm going to go out on a limb. I don't think it's going to take 2 years. They said 2 years for the Intel transition. It took 9 months. I think they're under-promising and over-delivering.
Agreed.
I think, you know, Ming-Chi Kuo and others have repeated this, is there will be a 13-inch MacBook Pro this year running on Apple Silicon. And probably, I think Ming-Chi Kuo said all Macs sold in 2021 would be Apple Silicon.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Fast. And I wonder if that 2 years is because of a weird outlier like the Mac Pro, where that might take a little bit longer.
Yeah, what do they
we're
do
waiting
with that?
For the second generation of that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if the Mac Pro is just going to get a card, like an Apple Silicon card that you stick in it and you're like, all right, now you got
both. You could do that. You could do that, yeah.
I don't know. I think the difference between this transition and Intel is maybe going to be more about, all the Intel Macs were the exact same model as that came before. They looked exactly the same. All they changed, and that was all about stability, right? There's like, it's all the same. It's fine. Relax. I really feel like Apple has been holding out a lot of innovations.
Yes.
And so when you get that MacBook that gets announced, or iMac or whatever that gets announced this fall, and you're like, well, it's a little scary because it's Apple Silicon. And Apple says, well, yeah, but it's got Face ID and it's got a touch screen and it has Apple Pencil support.
And it's got 20 hours of battery life.
And you're like, okay, maybe I will buy it.
I'm already in line. I'm already in line. I can't wait. And I am not, by the way, I'm not only not buying any more Macs, I'm not going to buy any more computers. I think this is worth waiting for. I think we're seeing, this is a ledge. We've just gone, this is something unprecedented. It's all going to change. And I don't think it's just going to change for Macs. It's going to change for Windows. It's going to change for Linux. We are finally abandoning an antiquated architecture. We're moving on. I'm sorry, AMD and Intel. But that's the fact. And I think from the point of view of users, it's going to be a good direction. I think the fact that Apple hadn't changed the design in years, which made no sense and drove us all nuts, now makes sense. I think they have probably some beautiful designs. I wouldn't be surprised at all if all the new Macs looked completely different. The bezels disappeared. Suddenly, they got very modern, very fast, because that's another thing that could drive this market along.
Mm-hmm.
You agree?
Like all the times we were frustrated, like when the most recent MacBook Pro, the 13-inch, got updated, and why didn't they put a better webcam in there?
Right.
I bet.
Right.
What we're gonna start seeing is now there's a better webcam. Now there's Face ID. Now there's Touch ID. Now there's a T3 chip in your Touch ID. All of that, it's going to snowball year after year after year. And it's not going to be, now we're using another version of a lake in our processor. And that's all you get. We're going to see big changes.
I think also when you go to the high end, there's opportunities with ARM. You know, this week, another completely coincidental announcement, the fastest computer in the world was debuted. It is completely ARM powered, and I'm sure that Apple didn't talk to this Japanese company and say, "Hey, could you just release that on W?" But the Fugaku, developed in Kobe, Japan, by Fujitsu and Ryken, it uses as its chip a 48 core A64FX system on a chip. It is 415 petaflops, which is almost three times as fast as its nearest competitor. It's very convenient to Apple because, hey, you know what? ARM isn't slow. What made you think ARM was slow?
Yeah, I think people who think of ARM as these kind of underpowered mobile chips. Mark Gurman's report in April about what the first Mac ARM chip would be, he said it's a 5-nanometer process. So right there, that's really interesting. And it's 12 cores, 8 performance cores, and 4 power saving cores. A 12 core. So imagine you're a 13-inch MacBook Pro with 12 cores on a 5-nanometer processor. This is not a toy chip. This is the real, deal. There's a lot of potential here.
The other transformative thing that the iPhone brought was these systems on a chip, where because of obviously for compactness and price savings, you were able to put everything on a chip, including, by the way, the GPU. A GPU on die is going to be better than any third-party card you put in your computer. I don't care how fast the bus is. The fact that you can, because of the improved thermals of RISC processors, of ARM, you could make systems on a chip that are, you already are. It's called the iPad Pro. They're mind-boggling, the A12X. I think this could be revolutionary. Your Mac Pro could have 100 cores on it.
I just remembered how mind-blowing it was when they announced the Apple Watch with the S1 chip in it. And you're like, they fit the entire system in a wristwatch.
Yeah, it's the size of your pinky finger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and you could throw 40 of those in a Mac Pro easily, exactly. Right? Like, you know, exactly. there's a potential for a lot of power there, especially when you can tweak things. And fundamentally, again, it always comes back to control, right? The stuff Apple can do when it's not bound to waiting for Intel to catch up on its year-long roadmap is going to provide them so much more flexibility, right, in terms of that, the interoperability, right? Like the fact they don't just control the GPU and the, you know, the processor, but also like the power management chips. They're going to start building their own cellular modems, right? Like you start putting all these things together and it's like you can get a lot out of it when you control every single piece of the equation.
Apple's battle with Qualcomm, which forced them to use very subpar Intel modems in its phones, was a nightmare. You can just imagine the pain Apple felt having to build those phones. But the beauty of owning the entire stack, just the whole damn thing, owning the entire stack is there is not one transistor in there that isn't purpose-built to do exactly what it needs to do.
Yep. If you think about what a classic PC was, right? A PC maker was building out of components.
Then it was in off some, the shelf, you know, literally.
Exactly right. And when you talk about this being a real transitional moment for the computer industry, I think one of the things that the smartphone world has really pushed, and it's very clear now that this is what Apple thinks, is a computer manufacturer is not an assembler of parts. A computer manufacturer is a maker of a system on a chip. That is how Apple views themselves now. They put everything in there, the disk controller, the security, like the processor, the GPU, the memory, like it is all baked in there. And that is, you know, if you don't do that, it's going to be hard to compete, which is why I think that everybody else is taking notice.
I agree. Even when Microsoft put out its Windows on ARM Surface, it claimed, oh, it's a custom Microsoft chip. It was basically a Qualcomm chip with a sidecar. But that's clearly the future. That's where you want to go in the long run. I think, look, I know everybody's saying you drank the Kool-Aid, Leo. I did. I drank the Kool-Aid. I enjoy doing that once a year. But in this case, I think this is a very interesting transition. And I think it's transformative to the PC industry as a whole. It is a different beast than we've seen before. And I think it's potentially very, very powerful. Let's take a little break. There's lots more to talk about. If you hate Apple, this is not the show for you. I might as well just say it. We will talk about some other non-Apple subjects, but it's pretty much about Apple and what Apple's doing and how that is about to change a lot of things for everybody in computing. Lori Gill is here from iMore.com. Always a pleasure to have Lori, a regular on our show, Mac Break Weekly. And from Six Colors, Dan Morin and Jason Snell, two of the best, most astute observers of the Apple space, and prolific podcasters in their own right. Our show today brought to you by Roman. I have to say, being a guy, I know this. We don't like to go to the doctor. It's not like our favorite. Who does? Nobody does. But guys are like, this is how we're brought up. Oh, walk it off. You get hit by a baseball in Little League. No crying in baseball. Walk it off. Rub some dirt in it. You'll be fine. And that, as an adult, turns into kind of an aversion. It'll be fine. That giant growth on my butt, that's going to go away. Don't worry about it. It'll be fine. Well, guys, there's some things you really should probably see a doctor about. And Roman's here to help. It is a digital health clinic for men. They started, as you might know, they started with ED medication, and anybody who's dealt with erectile dysfunction knows that is not the first thing you want to talk about with anybody, not even a doctor. But Roman is a simple, convenient solution to get the treatment you need without leaving your house. So it started with sexual health, but it's so much more now. It really is your friend, your buddy online, a licensed doctor in your state, digital health for men. Discreet professional care, genuine prescription medication, but they also have over-the-counter treatments delivered in unmarked packaging. Sexual health, ED, of course. By the way, really good news. Many of these ED treatments have now become generic. The patents have worn off. The prices have dropped dramatically. So really now, these are medications you get very affordably, and it's even more affordable with Roman. hair and skin, dandruff, eczema, daily health, prostate health, bone health. They have a supplement packet I take that's fantastic for older guys like me for prostate health and testosterone. Grab your phone, grab your computer. You can complete a free online visit. It's free. You'll hear back from a U.S. licensed physician within 24 hours. It's at GetRoman.com/twit. And if the doctor agrees the treatment's right for you, and by the way, that's why it's so important you speak to an actual physician. You know, this is telemedicine. It's very exciting. It's a real transformation in how medicine is delivered these days. But if the treatment's right for you, they can ship the medication direct to you. You'll get free two-day shipping, free unlimited follow-ups with your doctor, free unlimited anytime you have a question or you want to adjust your treatment plan. With Roman, there's no commitment. You can cancel at any time. It's very affordable. It's the right way to go, and it's sure a lot better than rubbing dirt in it. Trust me. If you're struggling with ED, stay home and go to GetRoman.com/twit for a free online visit and free two-day shipping. GetRoman.com/twit. I feel like almost this is a public service announcement. I really feel like this is an important thing, and I'm really glad we can talk about it amongst friends. GetRoman.com/twit. You don't have to suffer. Get Roman. I would love to talk about other stuff too, but there were so many announcements at WWDC. I feel like we got the team to do it. We've got to run them down. It is now Mac OS 11, right? They're not going to, 10 is dead,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, they removed the branding 2 years ago, and now it's officially 11.0 if you check the about box.
Only took 19 years or so. Is that?
You know, and 11 makes a lot of sense. Although they're at iOS 14, maybe they should have made it 14. I don't know. 11's fine.
I think I spoke about this before. I think the thing is, if you go from iOS 10 and in whatever, you know, Mac OS 10, OS 10 point, you know, all of the different 10 versions of what Mac has been for this whole time, if you just jump to 14, you're really just saying, we're just changing the number. We're just catching up.
Right.
But if you go, if you say, I'm going to 11, what you're saying is, this is a brand new, completely redesigned operating system. So I think it, like, for the marketing perspective, it made a lot of sense that they went to 11, because what they're saying is, we're not just catching up with the other naming schemes. What we're doing is proving to you in this wording what a big deal it is that we're changing this the operating system.
It also eliminates any thought that, they're turning it into iOS.
That too. Yeah.
That would be
bad. I think Craig Federighi said on the talk show with John Gruber.
Go ahead, Jason.
The same thing, which is sometimes people say, this is too much thought. It's just a version number. And Craig Federighi said it. Like, they talked a lot
about what
to call this and how to execute changing it from Mac OS 10 to Mac OS. And then and what number was it going to be? And I think Lori's exactly right that calling it Mac OS 14, although it would be in lockstep with iOS and iPadOS and tvOS, it would be the wrong message, right? It would be, it's just another adjunct to the iPad. And they didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
And if you're going to change it after 20 years, I mean, clearly you want to put some thought into it, and you don't want to have to deal with when Windows skipped to 10, right? And everyone's like, what happened to Windows 9? You know, and everyone's like, let's just not talk about it. I think that was, it's not the biggest deal in the world, but I think Laurie's totally right that it's all about showing respect for what came before, as well as it kind of harkens back to what Jason said about the Intel Macs looking the same as the Macs that came before it. Is like it's a certain amount of stability, especially when so much else is changing in the release. It's like, don't worry, we're just going one number. Like, we're sticking with the version numbering that we're just gonna increment by one instead of by four.
Also,
all the Spinal Tap references we get to make now, man.
I bet you that was
full of them.
I bet you that was a negative, not a positive. Maybe, I don't know. Craig made all those jokes about taking acid or something in the keynote. That's so weird.
Crack marketing team.
The crack marketing. That's so weird. it's nice. By the way, is this a good format for WWDC? Should they do this from now on?
Some of the stuff's great. Some of the stuff is great. I think having the access afforded by having the videos immediately available, not having to, you know, essentially pack people in a room. And as Jason and I can tell you, having watched a bunch of these, like, you know, making these sessions exactly as long as they need to be instead of having to fill a time block and having as many of them as you want instead of having to worry about how many rooms do we have, right? Like, avoiding all of that logistical stuff, I think, really helps them deliver talks that are much more useful. But obviously you do lose a huge amount of the social aspect, which is really sad to see, because, you know, we all liked going and seeing friends. And even if you didn't go to the conference, you would get, you maybe go and hang out. And, you know, it's a great opportunity to meet new people who are in the same business. So I think there's some downsides to it, but I think from an information delivery standpoint, it's hard to argue that it's not superior to packing yourself in a small conference room, especially right now.
I wouldn't mind seeing them do this forever. And I'll tell you what I love about it is it's inclusive, not exclusive.
Yep.
I can't, first of all, as a journalist, I was always thrown out after the keynote at WWDC. I want to see the tracks. I want to see them all. There's lots of people who can't afford to fly to San Jose, can't afford the ticket. The tickets are in short supply anyway. Not everybody can buy one, even if they have the wherewithal. I think it's why wouldn't you want to make a developer conference available to all? Sure, you miss the face-to-face. John Gruber's got to Zoom Craig Federighi and Jaws instead of sitting on a stage. Big deal. I don't think the face-to-face is as valuable as it used to. I mean, I like having you sit next to me, Jason, when you come up to do Twitch. But we're getting a show done. It works, you know.
Yeah, it works. Yeah, I think it's been free for everybody the last few years. And Dan's point about, like,
okay,
not
okay.
You've been able to watch it, but it's still been, like, mm-hmm. in the conference center, in these time blocks, 50-minute slots and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And they have been freed from that. And an education for developers, which is really what it's supposed to be, it is vastly superior this way. I'm curious, they're trying online, like, labs where you sign up for office hours to talk to Apple engineers. I'm going to be interested to see those people who went through that, how that works.
Yeah, I wonder what that was like, because
that
is important.
That was the big question.
That
right?
is important, like, mm-hmm. that face-to-face.
There are sessions, but they're all on video, but... Right. I can go into a lab and I can see the engineer who is working on the thing that my app relies on, and I can say, why doesn't this work? And they can give me an explanation. That's super valuable. And if they can't replicate that well online, then that would be a reason to do it. But in terms of the sessions, these sessions are the best WWDC sessions ever. And if what they want to do is educate developers, they should do it like this every year.
You bet. I think Microsoft's going to do that. I think their Build conference was fantastic. I think that Apple should do it. I wonder what Google's going to do. They deferred at Google I.O., but I think they're probably watching this going, yeah, this isn't a bad way to go. After all, you want as many people as possible to develop, especially now. You want to get everybody sitting down and doing this. They've been giving away Xcode forever. That's just more of the same. So good.
I think there's really something to be said for the in-person part of it, though. The shaking hands with people that you know and networking and things like that, it's more valuable than you might think. You learn about new processes that other people are doing, not just, you know, an Apple engineer to a developer, but developers to each other. There's things like AltConf, like other conferences that take place around the same time, where you again, learn about new things, new technologies, new things that are going on, startups that are happening. I think that it should continue as an in-person event, though I like the idea of maybe a hybrid version, you know, just like the two of you are saying about the quality of each one of these sessions and the ability to time it out to whatever it needed to be. I think that is very important, but I don't think that we should just, that Apple should just completely be online for the future, because I really do think that there's a lot of things that developers miss out on by not being in attendance. And maybe that like why people go might shift and change a little, but that would still allow for that to continue.
I'm not a designer. So Apple made it like the new design of Big Sur is a really big deal. And to me, I just like, okay, whatevs. But maybe you guys have an aesthetic that I lack. Is there much to say about? I have to say it's weird that the control they've got the control panel on.
So there's two things that I think are important here. One is I think a lot of this is about reducing friction between people moving back and forth between iOS, iPad, and Mac. Like it's kind of starts to look the same. Like Jason said earlier, like the stuff you're seeing in the iPad now with the sidebars and the drop down menus. It lets them move everything forward, but kind of bring things into alignment a little bit more. So if you jump back and forth between your iPad and your Mac, you're not going to experience quite as much like, oh, where is that thing? Or how do I do this thing that I can do over here, but now on this device? And if you're now, as we discussed in the first part of the show, if you're running iPad OS apps and iPhone apps on your Mac, it reduces some of the potential friction for design differences there. Those perhaps don't stand out as much. They don't look as alien if the interfaces are kind of converging towards the same point. And, you know, as we also discussed, moving the elements and changing them in such a way that they maybe are a little bit more iPad-like could open the door for a touchscreen option on the Mac.
I have to say, looking at this, I have to say I agree with you more than I did at first because all the touch targets are big. This is just
the menu bar is bigger. Yeah. All of the individual menu items are taller.
Yeah.
All the app icons, because you're going to be able to run on Apple Silicon Macs, iOS and iPad apps. They made all the Mac apps also have the little round rack icon thing so that all the icons kind of look alike. They could have made them like, no, Mac icons don't have round racks. They didn't do that. Right. They're like their apps. All apps are shaped the same way. Right.
Yeah.
So I looked at the Big Sur design and I thought, oh, maybe they really are going to make touchscreen Macs. And then knowing that they're going to run iPad and iOS apps as well, just kind of doubly makes me think that.
Yeah. The control panel, for instance, which they're taking directly from iOS, is not a mouse affordance. That's a finger thing.
I mean, they added some nice Mac stuff to it. Like you're going to be able to drag things out and put them in the menu bar, which is a concept that doesn't exist except on the Mac, the idea of a menu bar. But yeah, Control Center, it's a nice interface and it's familiar. I think the argument would be, is that about accommodating touch or is that, as Dan said, about accommodating people who are used to the concepts in iPad and iPhone?
Yeah, but look at that slider. That is just my finger. I mean, that's huge. That's huge, that slider. You know, it seems to me that's what they're going for. That's really going to be an interesting.
There's also some design changes in iPad and iPhone that allow things for like drop down contextual menus.
I think it's
all doing that, like bringing them together on all sides, not just making Mac look more like iPad and iPhone, but also making iPad and iPhone act more like Mac so that across the board we're just more familiar with, instead of saying, how do I find that menu? Where is it? How do I get to it?
Right.
We know how to do it on all three devices, and that just makes it a more like better flowing experience for us.
Messages was a big difference too. I'm an idiot, but I was sitting there going, and Android? But no, of course, they're never going to do messages for Android. This is the ultimate ecosystem lock-in. But I have to say that I don't use group messages a lot, but it looked like those were for people who do, those features are going to be very, very powerful. Inline replies.
It's a lot of lessons learned from other chat apps that messages really needed to do. All of us have been punished by a group chat and messages at one point or another. And being able to, the mentions thing where you can turn off all notifications, but if somebody says your name, you get notified. That's a winner. I like that.
Love that. That's making it more like Slack.
Nice, Threads
exactly.
And mentions and all of that stuff. I've already like upgraded on at least one of my devices and I have a couple of regular group chats and I'm like putting replies in. I was like, oh, you guys can't see any of this. Like, I can't believe I have to wait for you to upgrade your devices.
You're missing out.
We should just start a group chat so we can just do that with each other.
Yeah.
We should say that messages on the Mac is Catalyst. And this is a good example of why Catalyst got a bad reputation, because of some of Apple's tentative steps with Catalyst on the Mac were kind of not very good, but like I've used the messages in Big Sur a little bit, and messages is an app that kind of Apple left by the wayside on the Mac, and it missed a lot of the features. Messages on Big Sur, it's pretty good. It doesn't feel super weird, and old messages was actually really kind of bad. So I think that that and the Maps app as well, which they brought over using Catalyst, I think they feel good, which makes me feel better about Mac Catalyst again, because good app experiences under Catalyst is a good sign for the future.
You know, somebody's bringing this up in the chat, and I didn't mention it when we were talking about hardware, but I wonder what happens to Thunderbolt on Mac, on Apple Silicon.
I have an answer for that. So USB 4 is Thunderbolt 4.
Right.
It, basically, they're the same. Right. There's just one spec with one connector,
right,
the standard USB-C connector. And my understanding, the reports I've read say that that's due this fall.
Yeah.
I would not be surprised if Apple's first Apple Silicon Macs were USB 4 Macs.
USB 4.
And they built their own USB 4 / Thunderbolt ports that would be compatible, backward compatible with all existing Thunderbolt and USB-C stuff. It would not surprise me at all if that's the story here, that they didn't bother building Thunderbolt 3 stuff because they could use the Intel chipsets for that, but they did engineer the new stuff to work with this stuff. So that's my hope. I hope we don't end up with like an interim generation that's sort of just USB only. Yeah. That would be not as good.
No, that's exactly what I was thinking. This is the perfect opportunity to move to USB 4 with very little downside. Your Thunderbolt 3 stuff will still work. Your multi-display systems will still work.
Exactly.
And you get the same 40 gigabit per second throughput on USB 4. So there's really...
Yeah, and even though Thunderbolt is an Intel-owned thing, it's licensed and Apple has a license and it's not a big deal. Like, it is a standard. I think the licensing for Thunderbolt or USB 4 is completely open because it's a USB adopted standard. So it's like, preferably, it's kind of not an issue. Apple will just write their own controller and won't be relying on Intel to do it.
Plus, right.
It opens up possibilities on the iPad side as well, right? If you've already got USB-C on your iPad Pros, that could move to USB 4 in the future. So that would be a huge benefit for those devices too.
Yeah. I feel like that's also part of the future, and actually a very big part. Ultimately, connectivity is important. And, I would like to see that. So good. All right. USB 4 timing, perfect. So what do you think? September, MacBook 13-inch, MacBook Pro, USB 4, Apple
Mac
Silicon?
OS has lagged a little bit, and I wonder if it'll be October where they'll try to... coronavirus, right? We don't actually know because of COVID-19 exactly when everything's going to ship. If I had to put money down, I'd say it probably more like October that they'll try to get an iPhone out in September and then the Macs will follow in October. But this fall, I think when Big Sur ships, Apple will be ready to sell at least a little bit of Apple Silicon Macs, but they need Big Sur for it.
Wow.
So I'm going to be the opposite of that just cause I can, cause I honestly don't know for sure, but here's going to be what I predict. I'm going to predict that we're going to get another Intel Mac in the fall with Big Sur, but they're gonna have the Apple Silicon Mac, whatever that is, that'll be ready before Christmas. And I think it's gonna be an iMac and a MacBook. That's those ARM ones. But we're gonna get an Intel Mac.
What? They did say we have Intel Macs in the pipeline.
He said they have more in the pipeline,
Is that gonna be?
Knowing Apple. When Apple says they'll do something by the end of the year, it oftentimes means December.
Right.
because they like to really stretch those things out. So, right before Christmas or right after. I mean, Pro, I think that was a Mac Pro. That was a thing. So, I'm with Lori that I think there's a MacBook and an iMac are both likely, because I think they're going to want to show the capability not only of the laptop form factor, but of the desktop, because that's going to be the big question, right? A laptop is something that fundamentally... it's kind of iPad-like, right? It's not an iPad, but it's kind of iPad-like, whereas they have never made a desktop with their own silicon. That is going to feel very different, and I think they really want to put, kind of like Jason said before, in terms of this is your opportunity to make a statement, I think they want to come out loud and strong and say, like, here is our desktop flagship, running ARM. So I think that's quite possible.
I'm saving my pennies. That's all I can say.
You're going to get one of each, whatever it is.
Oh. No problem. Absolutely. And I know there's a big risk buying the first one, but I don't think it's as big as it could be. In worst case scenario, it's an iPad Pro in a box.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the worst case. That's what they're selling. They're not selling, whatever they are, renting, loaning right now. And that seems, the whole demo they did, everything they did with Big Sur was done on that. That worked pretty well. We weren't saying, what's wrong with that? Why is that Mac so sluggish?
Well, and there were a lot of rumors about whether they were going to actually do Rosetta again or whether they were going to force everybody to recompile or it wouldn't be there. And of course they did Rosetta again, which means that all of your apps that are currently compiled to Intel, if they haven't been updated yet, they'll run. They'll probably be a little slower, but they'll run. And you can the best chip transition is one where the user doesn't ever really notice it happened.
Yeah. And I think it's no accident that they called it Rosetta 2 and Universal Binary 2. They want to emphasize, we've done this before. We know how to do this. And we're going to do the same thing. You know, it worked okay, right? How did it work last time? We're just going to be this, what time it's going to be. And it should actually a lot easier, really. They've been making these chips
for a while. No company has done as many of these transitions as Apple has, right? They have transferred their major platform several times.
Right.
And if anybody knows how to do it, it's them. And I agree. They're trying to maintain, like, look, all this stuff is going to work. It's going to be seamless. Frankly, I would not be surprised if some of the Rosetta apps run even better than expected, just because processor gains might mean they've got cycles to spare, right? Like, you might notice if you're doing something really intensive, but if you're running something that's like a word processor that hasn't been transferred over, you're probably not going to notice the difference. And that is exactly what they want.
Right. All right, so we've talked about potential pitfalls. I don't want to sound too cheerleadery, but we talked about that. A couple of people in the chat room said, you know, they should have skipped ARM and gone to the next thing, whatever that is, RISC-V or something. I don't know what the next thing is. We're acting as if ARM is, you know, golden manna from heaven. I'm sure ARM has other issues as well. But man, Intel's been bad. I mean, they've had trouble getting the process down to 10 nanometers. They've had horrific problems with their pipeline architecture. The prediction has caused all sorts of security issues that they just don't seem to be able to fix without killing performance.
And keep in mind, it's not fair to say like ARM versus Intel, right? Because ARM Holdings is a patent licensing company, but it's Apple Silicon. This is why they call it that and not ARM, right? It is Apple's design that they have relentlessly been pushing forward
for years. How much of ARM is in this? I mean, they have to have some compatibility. They license the ARM architecture, which means they can do whatever the hell they want. But they want some compatibility because they'd like to, for instance, be able to run other Linux that's designed for ARM chips on Apple Silicon. How close will these be?
I am not a processor person. So, I mean, my guess is that there is an ARM common, you know, instruction set that they have in common, but then they build
everything else around it.
Yeah. And it's all, I mean, my point is it's relentlessly driving toward Apple's hardware goals.
This is the next
in a way that nobody else can do. So it is the next thing because Apple knows what devices it wants to build. And that Mac processor, when it comes out, is literally designed for those Macs that it's running on. It's not something taken off a shelf from a reference and put in a piece of metal. It's literally been designed over the last 2 or 3 years specifically for the Macs that it's going to run on. And that's why Apple has an advantage there.
In a way, that's why I'm so excited about this, because for the first time in Apple's history, they get to design the whole stack. And to me, the potential there is unlimited. Steven Sinofsky, former Microsoft guy, he was the Windows 8 guy, tweeted, amidst all the details, I want to take a moment to reflect, putting it in context to the past 2 decades. Quite simply, what we're seeing is some of the most remarkable product engineering over time in history. He was as ecstatic, maybe more so than I am.
He's got the scars from Longhorn,
right? He's been there. Yeah. My jaw dropped when Tim Cook discussed the transition to Apple Silicon as a 2-year journey. First, that's like no time at all. Second, that's an incredibly long time to tell everyone how long it will take and that they should be patient. But really, it's incredibly brave when so much could change, more could go wrong. Every company does multi-year planning, but everyone knows those plans mean little after one fiscal year. Apple's entirely different in that regard. He was extremely impressed by Apple's process.
If I think about how long this has been going, we don't know. We hear like that this year's iPhone's already designed and this next year's iPhone is probably almost entirely designed already. Like, we hear that they work ahead. But the one that I keep coming back to is Apple announced that it was going to be getting rid of 32-bit apps on macOS. And they warned about that like 5 years ago. And then they said, we're going to put a warning in that it won't run after the next version. And they put that in High Sierra saying,
they took way too long.
And then, it was this long process to do that. But looking back, what they were doing is clearing out all the garbage. One of the arguments about Catalina and Mojave were both that they actually said they were trying to realign the underpinnings of macOS because it and iPadOS and iOS had drifted over the course of the years. So like this is like a 5-year plan that they have executed on, including very cleverly ripping out all the compatibility and blaming it on Catalina when it was probably ripped out for the silicon, Apple silicon, right? It was probably ripped out because they weren't going to emulate Intel 32 on ARM 64.
Right.
But they did it in steps. They warned everybody. They had confidence that they were going to get there, and they got there. And you know, we complain a lot. There are a lot of things to complain about details of various macOS releases. But they, you know, when Stephen Sanofsky points out that they've been releasing these things kind of every year, more or less, for 20 years, it is impressive. And they do make long-term plans, and they do generally seem to hit their goals.
Yeah. I think for those of us, everybody on this panel who watch Apple closely, a lot of things clicked into place with this announcement. Even though we knew it was coming, everything we kind of go, oh, that's why they did this. That's why Catalyst exists. That's why Replay. You talked, Dan, about the Replay Kit, which has been in iOS. Suddenly it's in macOS.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting.
There's a lot of stuff like that where because of the fact that iOS and macOS had different underpinnings and different layers, right? Like, and Jason mentioned earlier, what's fascinating about the iPhone and iPad stuff that's coming to the Mac is it's essentially built on the same technology that Catalyst was already using, right?
Yeah.
So stuff like Replay Kit and other things that were developed for iOS can make their way over now with basically no problem whatsoever. And that's huge because it means that you're not – the thing that I've always come back to with the macOS, iPadOS, iOS is how much time does Apple want to spend supporting two major disparate platforms? That's got to be a headache, right? So the more stuff that they can share between them – and yes, iOS and macOS do share fundamental underpinnings, but – as you spend this time and there's like, well, we need to do different things. This is mobile. This is a desktop, et cetera. Like it just gets to be more work. And so I think having, if not like a full on convergence, they don't seem to want to merge these things, but they want to reduce the amount of time that they have to spend supporting two different things with two wildly different use cases. So having that ability to bring stuff over from iOS to the Mac, just super simply, is huge. It's just a huge potential win for them.
Sometimes in business and in technology, they talk about flywheels, how the additional technologies can support each other in such a way that you get incredible synergies and incredible power, and it continues to build and build and build. And you very much feel like that's what Apple has been engaged in over the last 10 years. In fact, really since iPhone came out. But perhaps they didn't understand what a big transformation that was going to make. Maybe they did. But in a few years, it became very clear that that was going to drive the company. And I think that was probably at the point where they started to say, you know, what we really should be doing is building an entire ecosystem around this that builds one on another, that can serve all our different disparate customers and disparate niches better. And I think they found that. I think that that's really what they're doing here.
It is pretty rewarding in some ways to think about the fact that all the advances in time and energy they put into the iPhone eventually just benefits the Mac, right? After all these years of people being like, oh, they're forgetting about the Mac. All they care about is their mobile devices. They turned around and was like, all that work we did,
makes
it's going to make
so
their Mac
happy.
So much better.
Exactly.
Right?
I was really feeling bereft. I felt like the Mac was about to go. We had many conversations on Mac Break Weekly where I said, it's over. And made me so sad because like most people, and actually Craig even said this when he was talking to John Gruber, we got into this, all of us at Apple started with the Mac. We got into this because we loved the Mac. And I think it's very credible now when they say that they hadn't abandoned the Mac, that what they were really doing is creating a new system that the Mac was a big part of. And so I don't know who we are losing. I don't know what that sound means, but I guess everybody's still there. So good. So you agree with me? This is good. If nothing else, this is very good news for the Macintosh.
Yeah, they have the luxury of building their next generation platform off to the side, thinking about mobile which is great because that's sort of the future of computers is these mobile devices. And then for all of us, it was that moment where we all, again, were like, what does this mean for the Mac?
Yeah.
And it's nice to see them kind of plow that back into the Mac now. But that's the advantage that Apple had over Microsoft, which doesn't have that kind of thing that they could work on in parallel, is that Apple just spent a decade building like new paradigms for a lot of the classic computer stuff. New Pointer. There's a great session, people should watch it, about pointer design on iPad, where they talk about how they reimagined that very old, like back to 1984 mouse cursor for iPad. And it's so brilliant that I'm a little surprised that it's not in Mac OS. I suspect it will be soon, that they'll change the cursor maybe next year. But like, they got to invent that over here. They got to reinvent some things about file handling, and they got to rethink security. And they did that while the Mac got to stay the Mac. And now that it's far enough along, they're like, all right, well, now it's time to plow all of that stuff back into the Mac. And I do think it will make the Mac better ultimately.
Yeah, woohoo is all I can say. Lots more to talk about. We're going to take a little break. Our show today brought to you by ExtraHop. ExtraHop is the new IT reality. Well, actually, the new IT reality, as you all know, is people working from home, remote access on a massive scale. And as a result, rapid cloud and multi-cloud adoption. Of course, we've seen this for a couple of years now, a steady increase in Internet of Things devices. And you know who loves all this? The criminals. A rise in cybercrime. So much more important than ever. Organizations see exactly what's going on in their environment. That cloud can't be a puffy little opaque cloud. You got to see into the cloud, to the data center, all the way down to the customer. In order to protect and scale your business, you need more than just unified visibility. You need context so that you can understand what you're seeing. You can have an intelligence response. Teams can collaborate easily, can act fast, can fix problems. That's where you need ExtraHop. It helps you detect threats and performance issues up to 95% faster and respond 60% more effectively. Just take a look at the ExtraHop dashboard. You can see it right now if you go to extrahop.com/twit. And I bet you look at it and go, that's what I need. I need that for our organization. That's, I think, what Wizards of the Coast said. ExtraHop helps keep your business secure and available. It's a SaaS-based cloud-native network with detection and response. Their chief architect at Wizards of the Coast uses it to secure and support the AWS cloud. Dan McDaniel, he's also their information security officer, said, there's no other company that aligns to supporting our DevOps model, the speed and the lack of friction, than ExtraHop. Ulta Beauty, you can see that on the page right there. They use ExtraHop to secure their Google Cloud and to keep their networking and security teams aligned so engineers have more time to focus on innovation. Senior IT engineer John Kreese says, before ExtraHop, we had limited visibility into what was going on in the cloud. But now we can quickly identify vulnerabilities and exploits and understand how our applications are performing in the cloud. Take control of your cloud security with ExtraHop. I tell you what, if you go and you take a look at the companies, the brands that use ExtraHop, and if you take a look at the dashboard right now at extrahop.com/twit, that full product demo, I think you're going to be so impressed. My reaction was, I need this now. I need to know now. Get tips on securing and supporting remote access. Check out the full product demo, extrahop.com/twit. This is the kind of useful intelligence that can make or break a cloud deployment. extrahop.com/twit. We thank them for their support. We had a fun week this week. What did we do? We did a scavenger hunt on Twit After Hours. Of course, we spent a lot of time talking about Apple. We've made a little movie for your enjoyment. Watch.
Previously on Twit.
Are you kidding? This is you in college?
I had my required street sign.
Yes.
And posters on the wall. Yeah. And I haven't changed a bit. Since then.
Twit News.
WWDC is an incredibly important event to Apple, our developers, and our users.
It applies in the full conversation, or you can view them as
that's
their
cool.
Own
give
like
me app
Reddit.
Mentions. Give me app mentions. Give me app mentions.
We're introducing mentions.
Yes.
With mentions, you can just type someone's name to direct a message to them.
Yes. I've only been so long.
Now you have the ability to.
hands-on Android.
As of now, Stadia is not officially supported on Android TV, and so you're going to need to jump through some hoops. But if you really want to play Stadia games on your Android TV device, that's why I'm here, and that's what I'm going to show you how to do.
Windows Weekly.
So we're talking about Apple's move from Intel to Apple Silicon.
Anyone who cares at all about Windows needs to watch this part of that presentation because they just blew Microsoft out of the water and they are never going to look back. What they're doing is incredible. And I hate this company.
And I'm saying that. Twit, bring your brain. We'll do the rest.
And we're not kidding. Innovating.
Just me doing sitting the there with an iPad facing him. Recording. Be funny.
Because we're all looking forward to a more hopeful tomorrow.
See, there's lots of room. I could have sat there. I could have done the whole thing. They just didn't invite me. At least this time I don't feel bad about not getting an invitation, right?
This is the first time I think I haven't been in an Apple event in like 20 years.
Is it really?
So weird. It was super weird. Yeah.
Were you disappointed it was pre-recorded? Did you want it to be a little more live?
I thought they did a great job with it, and having it open on the Steve Jobs Theater was super smart on their part. I liked the pacing of it. I would have liked them to try it live because I think it would be fun. The same time, it's Apple. They want control over it. Why would they make it live?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was just no way that was going to be live. And those drone shots were amazing. Although, Alex,
so
I thought they were great. Alex Lindsay said, well, they looked a little unsteady. I thought, Alex, come on, enjoy.
Alex.
Although, I have to admit, if Craig acted like we'd never seen the campus via drone. When, of course, that's all we saw for years was third-party drone shots as they built the campus. But that's okay, Craig. We know you never heard about that.
There's definitely a trick with the I think the Apple executives, they're super well coached. They really spend a lot of time doing these things. But it is funny. One of my co-hosts over one of the other podcasts, I do point out that Craig has the same level of enthusiasm for everything. He's like, you can run iPhone apps on the Mac. That's great. Also, there's a new button that we put here. And it's like you gotta measure that a little better because not everything is an 11.
They're good. They're good marketers. They always have been. Everybody and their brother got to interview Craig, and we didn't even try, probably because they would have laughed at us. But also, I hate interviewing executives because they are perfectly coached.
Yeah, I've got an interview.
They're still on task.
Yeah.
I've got an interview coming out tomorrow on my podcast Upgrade with a couple people who work at Apple, but they are not at that top level.
They're
one level down.
Yeah.
And they're still coached, and there are moments where you can – and I've interviewed some other people over the years, mostly at that lower level, and they're very knowledgeable, and they really want to dive in, and it helps kind of conflict with their training of sticking to the talking points. And it's not like they deviate, but they go a little more in depth because they know it a little more in depth. And I think you're right. There is, I never envy John Gruber interviewing super high level executives only because they are so well trained that you are probably not going to hear. There are tidbits here and there, but it's hard to get little tidbits out of them because they are so on brand, on message, and well trained. Yeah.
I just want to add, what was great about this year's format and being the fact that they filmed it all ahead of time was that I think it also gave them the possibility of bringing in many different presenters.
To see Johnny Cerruggi for the first time ever.
Yes.
Right. Because they don't have to worry about training them. Here's how you speak in front of an audience of 5,000 people. That is a different skill from here's how you speak to someone in a room with a camera shooting you. And that means you can probably bring in a lot more different executives, which also gives them an opportunity to showcase, a much more diverse pool of people working on these products,
Absolutely.
Which is also to their benefit. So I think that's actually another big effect of not doing this live. Is it gives them way more control and flexibility over who is involved in it.
That's a huge point. In fact, I neglected to make that point, but you're spot on. You put people in front of the stage in front of thousands of people. Most
Scary.
People seize up. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's hard to do a good job. And who knows if Johnny Cerruggi is scared of an audience or not, but getting him to talk about Apple Silicon, that's the guy you want to have talk about Apple Silicon, right?
Absolutely.
I'd much rather hear Johnny than Phil Schiller explain it. So at least to that extent, it wasn't just a marketing piece. Now, have you ever been in that lab? Was that a set or is that the actual lab? That felt like a set to me.
I've never
been in that lab.
I was measuring out where they've been. Where I mean, Apple Park. I haven't been anywhere but the Steve Jobs Theater or Apple Park. But they came up with a bunch of different spaces. There were, if you watch all the videos with the developers too, they're like, there are people who are on the outside of the ring looking out at the trees on the outside of the ring. There are people on the inside of the ring and you're looking at the little rainbow stage. There are people who are in the lobby, like Craig Federighi was, the lobby of the Steve Jobs Theater, on one of those two levels of lobby. And I suspect that the Johnny Cerugi stuff was similarly just in an interior space somewhere and not his actual lab.
Dressed.
But it made for a good joke, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's the secret. And all the music they played in that entire segment is all like spy music.
I was great. Yeah. They made a mock-up of the Get Smart. I thought it was the Get Smart set. Da-da-da, with the doors going open. And I thought that was great. Yeah, I loved that.
Well, they panned past Craig, too. I was like, they went past Craig. Yeah. And I was like, wait, was that Craig? And then they came back to him later. And I was like, it's weird.
They had fun doing it. You know what? That's great. That's what you know. That's the best you can do.
That's the kind of production value stuff too that actually does make it fun. That you couldn't watch it live. It wasn't just Tim Cook sitting on that stage.
That would have been
an empty audience behind him the entire time. Mm-hmm. There was all these fun things that got to happen.
And actually, having watched the similar presentation at Microsoft's Build Developer Conference, Microsoft got that too and did a lot of the same kind of fun, interesting stuff. And frankly, I never want to go back to stage presentations. And I think this is great. This is the way to do it. And if you have to have one-on-one somehow otherwise, that's fine. But
if you look at the developer sessions, they also, and those are,
you watched all of them, by the way, let me give you a plug, because Six Colors, you watched
a lot of sessions.
Holy cow.
We watched a lot. Not all of them. That would have taken, there were what, 600, 700?
Oh, okay.
There were a lot.
But I feel there was a lot. You did the best coverage. I felt like in many cases, I didn't have to watch the sessions. Because you did. Your coverage was just phenomenal. Well done.
You watch so you don't have to. But if you look, those presenters, although less polished, because these are often the engineers or designers involved with it, they put a lot of personality. So like there would be people with like little, there was a guy with a monocle and he had a newt on the table.
Wow.
There was a stuffed animal on a table. There was one session where all of the slides, when they cut away from the presenter, there was a shot of, I think, the presenter's hands doing a Rubik's cube. Like there was one session, which was about proximity, which is actually using the ultra wideband chip in the iPhone 11 to detect the location of another device with an ultra wideband chip. And in that one, the speaker just leaves the table and begins wandering around the room until he finds it, and then he gives a big thumbs up to the camera. It's hilarious. So like they, although it was beautifully art directed and the way they shot it was nice, they also made a point of giving, there you go, that's Radar the Aardvark. Everybody got a little chance to express their personality a little bit, and I think that that's super important, because it's so easy to view Apple as a black box and a monolith and this incredibly expensive company that, you know, it controls our world and blah, blah, blah. It's a different thing to have it like, there's a guy with the aardvark, you know, and it humanizes them. And that's good for Apple. It's good PR, but it's also good.
Ideally, what you do is you demonstrate that you are, in fact, a collection of individualistic geniuses. What you don't want to, and of course, from a corporate point of view, I know, I work in a business. I know what it's like. You want everything to be homogenized, because the last thing you want is a superstar. Or maybe you have a Johnny Ive, you have one or two superstars.
Right.
But really, you'd be much better off saying, do you know that Apple has 1,000 of the smartest people in the world designing these chips? And here's a few of them. That's a good message.
I'll tell you, watching all those sessions, what I got was Apple has, and you know, Steve Jobs really just wanted to be the face of it and not really talk about it. He was afraid people were going to get poached. But like, we were getting the names of everybody, we were getting their titles. And then if you talk, I mean, there was a lot of diversity that we don't usually see in the State of the Union in the keynote. But if you watch these sessions, you get the distinct impression, and it is the impression Apple wanted to give. But it's still hard not to leave with this idea that Apple has people from all over the world who are the best at what they do, who come to Cupertino, to Apple Park, and build their stuff. Because there were men and women from all over the world in those presentations. It was really remarkable. There were some people who are like me, you know, middle-aged white guys. They were there.
There was one guy
much more rare.
What was the guy, a little chubby? He was talking about the chips. He was in the Steve Jobs Theater. I took one look at him. I said, he's been there since the beginning. And in fact, he was the guy who came to Apple to do the A4 chip. And you could tell, long time. He's a 20-year guy. You could tell. Yeah. You could just tell.
Those guys are there. But, I mean, the gestalt of the event really was that it's...
Young, super smart.
And that, again, that's good PR. But also, those people exist. And they're presenting because they are the people working on those products and those features.
And also, kudos to Apple to let them be... themselves a little bit.
Bow tie guy.
I think that's really important. And I think that's a message Apple should. It's one of the things that I think all the big tech companies start to look a little homogeneous. Microsoft is just this blank wall. Google, it's a blank wall. What you really want to tell people is, no, these are the best. Google used to have that kind of gestalt that, oh, these are the best minds. They're all PhDs. They've lost that long ago. It seems like a bunch of stoners at this point. Can't focus on one thing for a minute. But if Apple could convince, and I think it's true, but Apple should show this. We have the money. We have the wherewithal. We have the cachet. We have the stock price to get the best people in the world. And that's who we've got working for you to make this product. That's a very strong message. I like that. What was there anything in the... I'm not going to be able to all watch all of these. Which ones are important to watch? Dan, you saw hundreds.
A lot. Maybe not hundreds, but I saw a bunch of them. I thought there were a lot of really good ones. I actually was watching a bunch of the ones on security because I find that's just an interest of mine. So, for example, I watched a great one about bringing Face ID and Touch ID to the web. So you'll be able to
log into your account
the web. It's great. It's super cool. But what's fascinating and what I love about it was watching something, and it's this typical fashion where Apple's like, this is great. Look how we're doing this. And then they mention this whole other thing. They're like, oh, for optional security, there's this whole other process called attestation where essentially your site can query the device maker and make sure like this is actually this device, right? Like we're looking at an iPhone and it does have Face ID. Like we can confirm that because we made that device and like we can check it all out. And they're like, that's great. Look, that's something that banks and, you know, other high security places might need. And then they're like, but you know what? It turns out that you could actually, that could have a privacy problem because when you issue these certificates to all these different sites, they can then compare them and do cross-site tracking. And they're like, so we just decided to anonymize it and just generated
every
time and made our own thing, right?
Yeah, like, baby. You're like,
this is typical Apple, where they're just like, that was great, but we took it a step further. Yeah. And like, this is not a thing they're ever going to talk about in the keynote, right? But when you start to dive into these sessions, you realize how much time and thought they've put into these processes.
More. Yeah, I want to see this. I like, you know, everybody who watches our shows likes getting under the hood and really... Here's the picture of the guy using UWB.
Yep. Found it.
It's over here. Yeah, I found it. Jason, were there any that stood out in your...
Yeah. Talking about attestation, if you want to see the lengths that Apple will go to build a feature, and the consortium, because it's the car key presentation, which is...
This is going to change the world, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going to involve new cars and new phones, so it's going to take for a lot of people 5 or 10 years for it to happen. But in the near term, it's NFC, so like Apple Pay. But in the long term, it's ultra wideband, and Apple is in this car consortium, and ultra wideband is this U1 chip in the iPhone. It lets you know exactly where you are in space. And as a result, it's going to be fairly easy to just walk out to your car. It knows you're at the door. It unlocks the door. You get in and it knows you're in the car, and then you press start and you go. That is how cars are going to work. We're going to use our phones. But then if you watch that session, you see like there are invisible messages being sent behind the scenes that you send one message that you can see that's like, I'm sharing my key with a friend. And then like it kicks off this whole chain reaction. There are attestations that happen between the servers saying, yes, that is my friend. And it is a remarkable session that's geared toward car makers, it's a German man speaking to car makers. But behind the scenes, some of those charts are like, there's so much cryptographic complexity going on because they want to make sure that they build this so that your car key is not hacked, basically. And so they go through incredible lengths to do that. I was very impressed. And then the other session I'd mentioned is designed for the iOS pointer. All these sessions are on the web. You can just go to Apple's site and you can view them. It's such, if you care about design or like computer interaction design at all, it's just an amazing session because it really is the designers who thought up how to do a pointer on iPad talking about like the philosophy of what pointers on computer interfaces mean and how they work and what's good and what's bad about them. And it's just, it's so smart and it will make you think about something you took for granted with a lot more detail. So yeah, that's the one that I like the most.
If you love technology, this is heaven. Lori, did you watch some of the tracks?
I've been able to get through a few of them, but not very many at all. But I did really like the app clips, the designing for app clips, in part because it gives us a window into what to expect. What this, because it seems a little like, I don't get it. I can use an app without having to use an app. That doesn't make sense. So watching this session kind of gave me a better idea of like what that means, what an app like actually does. So, you know, some of that stuff, Leo, I think you could like find a title that you like and you don't have to watch the whole thing because sometimes you just want to get like the consumer version of the information so you can like fast forward through some of the coding stuff and then, you know, get a better idea of a 30 or 40 minute session in 10 or 15 minutes, you know.
I'm trying, you know, I haven't written software for the Mac since the Macintosh Programmers Workshop and the, you know, the Inside Macintosh. By the way, I sadly lost years ago in a move somewhere, threw away or just, you know, gave away my app, my Inside Macintosh 3 volumes. And I was so inspired by this. I literally went on eBay and ordered some used, you know, it's only $50 for all 3 volumes because I want it. That was a miracle for me to read that. It was so beautifully spec'd out. It was all in the ROM on the Macintosh, and it made software development so much easier. So I haven't played with it, I mean, since Pascal and 68,000 assembly. Because honestly, in my heart, I want to do hardware independent stuff. I want to do, and which means mostly command line because GUIs tend to be dependent. But that's for me the fun part of programming. But having dipped, and I would recommend Big Nerd Ranch has a really good book on iOS development. They always do. They're in their 7th edition now, so I picked that up. And to me, watching these is really inspiring and fun. But it is a complex, deep ecosystem. And they've this has evolved considerably over the years. I think they've cleaned it up. I think Swift UI is really nice. I think that Xcode is pretty remarkable. And I think if you're a developer and you wanted to, you know, to me now, hardware dependent design is not so bad. If I get on an iPhone, an iPad, and a Mac, that's not a bad ecosystem to be in. So to me, it's exciting. I'm very intrigued. I want to do a speed round with you guys because the show's almost 2 hours long already, and we haven't even gotten iOS and iPadOS, and we haven't gotten to the watch, let alone all the other stories in the tech world, and I want to get as many of these as we can. Let me take a break and give you a chance. We'll do a quick speed round, just features that you're excited about in iOS and watchOS. I don't know if there's anything in tvOS, some of the new stuff that's coming down the pike. Lori Gill is here from iMore. She's managing editor at iMore.com. Dan Morin from Six Colors. It's Inconceivable, the Inconceivable podcast, and many other great shows. And, of course, my good buddy Jason Snell, the incomparable Jason Snell, also from the founder of Six Colors. You're doing well at Six Colors. I'm very pleased.
We're keeping busy.
That's a scary jump that you made, but you guys did a great job, right? You know, I mean,
it's been almost 6 years now, 5.5 years.
Yeah. So many have come and gone in that time. And I know that when you both were making that jump from Macworld and, you know, looking at the, you know, life ahead as an indie, that must have been very, very scary. But having also made that jump, I think it was a good jump, right?
Yeah, I don't regret it. Yeah. Dan?
Same. No, good. It's been a huge improvement to my life.
Yeah, it's a lot better than working for a big company. No fun. No fun it's at true. All. our show today, we're going to do a quick ad, then we'll get to the speed round. Zendesk is a new sponsor. I'm really excited I'm thrilled. I've been using and known about Zendesk for years. It's a service-first customer relationship management CRM company that builds software that is designed to improve customer relationships. Most of the time in life, we're customers. That's our job. And we want a company, we want to work with companies that know how to treat us. And the companies that I invariably say, gosh, they're doing it right. They're using Zendesk. This is a tough time right now for every company. Things are a little weird. Makes it hard to keep up with what matters most. But every company should know that it's customers first, right? And Zendesk is there to help. They're, right now, this couldn't be a better time because they're offering a six-month absolutely complimentary remote support bundle. You can use this for 6 months for free. It comes with the essential tools your team needs to stay agile, to keep connected with customers, whether it's by email, phone, chat, community forum, help center, social media. They do it all. It takes hours, to not weeks, to get up and running. You'll be using it tomorrow. And I have to tell you, I was talking about this with Lisa yesterday. Something about COVID, customer service, I was talking about on the radio too, has gone downhill. Here's your chance to shine, to impress your customers, to say, no, it's going to be better now. It's going to be better now because customers need you right now. Zendesk was built on a simple idea. Make customer service software that's very easy to use, that's accessible to anyone with a single dynamic help desk interface. You can implement it easily and quickly. It's very flexible, of course, so it can match not only what you're doing today, but what you'll be doing tomorrow. And it works right out of the box. So you get a instant experience, but then you can configure it to your preferences. You can add integration, other apps to make it, build it to suit. That's why it's used by everybody from startups to large enterprises. It can grow as you grow with powerful, innovative customer experiences that puts them within reach of every company, no matter the size, the industry, the ambition. I think Zendesk is a must have. And the companies that I work with, look at these companies. These are the companies who are famous for their customer service. The director of client-facing experience and analytics at Homebridge, Ben Chapman, here's a quote. He says, having all the customer data in a single place helps us to achieve a high and consistent level of customer satisfaction. We can collaborate better. We have the visibility to see and report on everything. Zendesk also, this is not to be minimized, also improves security by allowing us to control access to sensitive content. Isn't that nice to know they also are caring about your data protection? Zendesk works nearly everywhere. They have 150,000 customers across hundreds of industries, 30 languages. Look, the customer journey differs for everybody, but no matter what your business need, you need Zendesk. Flexible enough to pave the path that's best for your organization. And now there couldn't be a better time to do it. 6 months free, the remote support bundle, just in time, Zendesk.com/twit, Z-E-N, because that's how you'll feel when you start using it. Zen, Zendesk.com/twit. I wish every company would start using Zendesk. We were talking, who are we talking about? Oh, I won't mention it. Former sponsor guy called on the radio show. He says, I can't reach anybody. I said, it's weird. It's like COVID. Everybody's brains have drained out slowly, and everybody's just gone, hi, customer service. We, and I have to, I'm going to actually do this on the air. We apologize because we had a company doing our, no, this isn't a Zendesk. This is not Zendesk. We had, I wish they had been using Zendesk. We had a company doing our merch, t-shirts and stuff, masks. We had these beautiful masks. And they just went off the face of the earth. They just disappeared. They stopped responding to calls, requests. And I really apologize. If you ordered a mask and it was misdelivered or you didn't get it, please contact us. Send an email to Jerry. He's our marketing guy. Jerry@twit.tv. We will make it good. Even if we can't get the company to make it good, I will personally write you a check. We will make it good because I don't want anybody to be
out. You should personally make them a mask.
I will make you a mask if you want. Actually, the masks they made were great. We did get some, but I don't know. There's something went on. It's like the company. Honestly, I think it's COVID. I know it's COVID. The production facility shut down. The customer service died. The whole thing just collapsed. And I'm sure they'll come back after COVID. We have switched. We're with another company. They're very good now. And we have masks again, and they're being delivered properly and all that. But if you had ordered with us earlier, and any time you have any issues with Twit merch, we don't do it. We always go through a third party, but we will make it good. I don't want anybody to suffer. And we don't make money on the stuff. We just do it because it's nice if you wear a Twit thing once in a while. These are the new masks, by the way. If you want Steve Gibson on a mask or a bandana, I like that too. Here's your chance. It's just twit.tv/store. And this is a new company, so this guy is working. But I apologize for anybody who got it just took forever. I don't know what was going on. I really don't. It's very weird. They should have used Zendesk. Clearly. All right. Speed round. I'll start because there's a feature. It's an accessibility feature. As is often the case, Apple hides some of the best features under accessibility. It's the double and the triple tap. That is the coolest thing. On the iPhone, you can assign it to different tasks. I presume at some point I'll be able to do Apple shortcuts with it. I think I can. So that means I can do anything.
Yeah.
That's freaking awesome.
I was thinking about how when the protests started happening, and I believe it was Matthew Castanelli created a shortcut that allows you to ask Siri to open up your camera, film something, and then share that with friends or put it in a cloud storage. What if you didn't even have to say something? What if you could just double tap your phone and that exact same shortcut could pop up? Isn't you could awesome? Subtly do it. Yeah.
What are you excited about, Lori Gill?
Oh, there's so much.
You could do a few. Don't limit it.
It's hard to unpack them all. Well, so I actually found out how much I really do love being able to customize my home screen. I didn't think I cared. Yes. And now that I can, I think I've told you, I have a dozen folders with all of my apps all properly organized. So I didn't think I was going to really like this that much. Turns out I love it. I love being able to have my home screen has almost nothing but the widgets on it because I can. And it's just neat to be able to have that stuff being interactive. And the fact that you can hide home pages, so I can create an entire home page that's nothing but work apps. And then hide it at 5 o'clock or whatever. Yeah. Like, I love that idea. Yeah.
It's the first time Springboard's been updated in years. But finally, and it's, people are going to say, well, Android's been doing that. But I think they do it a little bit more elegantly, frankly, than Android. But we'll see. Yeah, I agree with you. That's a very nice feature.
It's a big one. Yeah. There's little ones, too. Let me see if I can find. And speaking of accessibility, this to me is absolutely incredible that this is even technology that's possible. So when you have a group FaceTime, the person talking, their bubble becomes larger to let you know that, the speaking person is highlighted.
Simple.
So in iOS 14 and iPadOS 14, the person speaking sign language will actually become the larger bubble. It recognizes sign language and then emphasizes that person's bubble. How incredible is that? How impressive is that? So even if you're in a group where some people are speaking with their mouths and other people are speaking with their hands, it recognizes that and gives that person the spotlight of the bubble. Wow. So that's really cool.
Very cool. Jason Snell, is there anything you're excited about in iOS 14 or WatchOS 7?
Yeah. A couple of years ago, we went on a road trip and we were in downtown Salt Lake City and all of the parking meters there are app-based.
Oh,
and
I
spent
that.
Like a good 5 or 10 minutes downloading an app and entering in my credit card information while holding my phone and my credit card and all of that. And then in order to get to pay to park.
Yep.
And Apple is doing this thing called App Clips, which is kind of like the slices idea that Android has tried and it really hasn't gone anywhere. But, Apple has proven that they're really good at popularizing stuff. So this may work. The idea is you scan a barcode or an NFC code, or actually you can even tap on items in maps or scan something on a table. There are like lots of ways to do it. And it automatically downloads a little mini app from the App Store and launches it. And so, for example, with that parking meter, if the parking meter has an app clip, which is what these things are called, if they support sign in with Apple and they support Apple Pay, I could literally go boop, tap my phone to the parking meter and go sign in with Apple Pay, done. And I paid for parking. without ever going to the App Store, without ever entering anything in. That's the dream. We'll see how it happens. The other way they described it is you could use it for Apple Maps to like order in advance before you get there, and it would just open an app clip and let you say, yeah, I want a muffin and a coffee, and you could go. You could even do it if you wanted to embrace the app clip lifestyle, like put different codes on different tables in your restaurant. And so then you wouldn't even need to say like where you were or who you were. You literally just scan it and say what you want, and they know what table you're at because it was embedded in the QR code or the NFC code that you scan.
Living La Vida app clips.
So
there's even customizable app clips. So you can have one restaurant, let's say, that has a restaurant app clip, but also has the wine and beer app clip.
Right. And it goes the other way too, where if you're like somebody like Yelp, instead of it being a Yelp app clip, when you scan it at a particular restaurant that's using Yelp, it'll show up as that restaurant powered by Yelp. Right. But they get their branding and all of that in there too, which I think it's very clearly Apple talked to a lot of different potential stakeholders about how to implement this, and they did a smart job of it. So
why didn't Android slices, which are essentially the same thing, small bits of the app that load as you need them, why didn't that take off?
You would know better than me. I would just say that Apple tends to be really good at marketing, and both to the general public and to businesses and to its developer base. And therefore, this has got maybe a better chance of working than
there's
the slices
always the
thing.
Risk that people won't support it. But I have to say, it's very easy. I did play with writing one. It's not hard at all. And it's only, you know, it's limited to 10 megabytes, but the fundamental functionality. And, you know, one of the things that makes this work that perhaps Android didn't have down so much, Apple Pay. And
if you can put all of those things together, it's pretty compelling, right? And
log in
and in the
Apple,
end, what do they
Apple
get out
Pay.
Of it? They get money.
Yeah. Yeah. Apple gets 30%. Nice deal, Apple.
Yeah. Yeah. And the parking meter gets people to pay easily and not get frustrated. And I think that's probably good too. The other one I'll mention really quick is Shortcuts. We mentioned that new back tap feature will launch a shortcut. Shortcuts are on the Apple Watch, which the previous app before it was Shortcuts, bought by Apple, called Workflow, was on the watch, and they took it off, and it's back now. And depending on how it's built, you can actually have Shortcuts that just run on the Apple Watch and don't ever talk to the phone, and they just do their thing. And you can save individual shortcuts as complications on your watch faces, not just a link to the app and then you tap the shortcut. You can actually pick a specific shortcut and put it on your Apple Watch, which there's a lot of potential there too.
The Apple Watch is taking off. The fact that we can now have our own custom complications alone makes a huge, huge difference. Will, I was a little worried because I do a show called Hands on Mac, which is Mac Tips, and I'm thinking, I'm going to do some Automator tips. And then I thought, God, I wonder if Automator will be around much longer. Are they going to, you think, replace Automator with Shortcuts on Mac OS at some point?
I don't think replace. I think Automator is going to keep going because AppleScript's going to keep going. But in the long run, I think I was surprised actually that Shortcuts isn't on the Mac in Big Sur, because I think it is coming, and I think you will want to have it there. And then in the long run, I'm sure Automator and AppleScript will maybe fade into the background a bit, but they're bringing them over to ARM. And I use Automator every day to do, like you said, shell scripts kind of stuff. The best way to integrate in the Mac interface with stuff that's happening in the Unix subsystem is to build little tiny services plugins using Automator that just run shell scripts. And I love it. So that's still there. But I use Shortcuts workflows all the time on my iPad, and I would love to do that on my Mac too.
Well, and I think AppleScript is widely used in Prepress and other places, and I don't know if Apple wants to lose those customers. So
I mean, they're not killing a lot of this legacy stuff because they know their customers want it. And there's no reason to kill Automator and AppleScript. They're not putting any effort into them, but there's no really real reason to kill them. And so I think they'll just keep them around. But I will say, having used Shortcuts a lot on iPad, there are a lot of things that Shortcuts is way better at than Automator. It's, you know, its limitations are mostly Mac versus iPad things. Like on the Mac, I can go to the command line, and I can't really do that on the iPad. I can go to some other device's command line using SSH, but I can't go to my iPad's command line because it doesn't have one.
That's interesting. I would not mind having having the three layers. You have AppleScript, you have Automator, and at the highest level, you have Shortcuts. That could be a great ecosystem.
All I got to do is run a shortcut thing in Automator and run an Automator thing in Shortcuts, and you got it. You got a bridge.
Then really the sky's the limit. All right, Dan, your turn.
I'm excited by all of the sort of translation everywhere stuff that Apple is doing. Mm-hmm. So there's a translation app coming to iOS. There's translation built into Safari. I mean, this is stuff obviously that Google has done with Google Translate, and they've done it well for years, and Apple is no longer content to sort of cede that ground. But, you know, I think back to a few years ago when my now wife was working in India, and I went and stayed with her for 6 weeks, and I had to be there one day when the guy came to repair the air conditioner in the room, and it turned out that he only spoke Hindi. And so I had to like call my wife at work, and she had to put one of her coworkers on, and we're like trying to navigate this phone chain. And, you know, I thought, well, it was so much easier. Like, technology should exist, and it does exist, but how well does it work? So the fact that it can do all this and it can do it all on device as well, which I think is a big thing. You know, Apple's pointing out the privacy aspects of that. I think that's kind of huge. So being able to just build that in and make it sort of a one-click thing in Safari is a big deal, honestly. And not just obviously being reliant to Google's technology is great for Apple. But it also potentially provides a good competitiveness for its users, right? Like in terms of Google and Apple having to work a little bit more in order to make a good product. So I'm really excited about that. I think that's potentially a really big improvement. They've only got a few languages right now. I was disappointed the other day because I saw a tweet about one of my books and it was on a podcast in Swedish. Uh-huh. And I was like, oh, I'll go to the website. I can translate it. And it doesn't support Swedish yet, unfortunately. So that was one thing. The other one I wanted to throw out there was, it's funny, I think the last time I was on Twit was right before the corona. It was at the very beginning of the coronavirus, because I remember us talking about, I think it was maybe when... was it Mobile World Congress was canceled? And the addition in watchOS 7 of the wash your hands timer.
I love that.
I love it. I do, because I have become obsessive ever since I was on that show. When you're, oh, you got to wash your hands. All right, 20 seconds every time. And so I love, it's a clever little thing that Apple shows, like, look, we've recognized that this is a thing we're all doing. Here's something maybe we can do that helps a little bit, push things forward, and just making sure everybody's taking good care of themselves. And you know, it's clever. And so I really enjoyed that a lot. I think that's a very fun and immediately useful thing that you can have.
Yeah, actually, I appreciate their adding dance and cool down to renaming, what are they calling activity now? Fitness.
Yeah,
that's more appropriate. And I do think that, so they're watching your hand motions. Apparently washing is an unusual motion. And then they're also listening, they said, for the squish of the soap, which is hysterical. And then it puts up a little timer on you and to make sure that you wash, and it will tell you.
Stop. Yeah, exactly. It'll tell you, you got to keep going. So
not done yet. I wish they do something. You're touching your face. You're touching your face, Leo. Stop touching your face. I'll have to just do it with my other hand. That's
proximity sensor alert. That just
I think they could do that.
As it gets close to your face.
That's right. Like when your car, right? When you're back in your car in the driveway.
Beep, 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 beep.
There's also some new AirPods and AirPods Pro features coming. There's you know, not just the spatial awareness stuff, but there's accessibility features that are going to be used beneficial with AirPods Pro, like opening up. Oh, you can customize the EQ of your AirPods Pro based on your hearing needs. So,
I
have tinnitus.
Yes.
So I can't hear bright noises. It hurts me to hear bright noises. Right. So I would EQ a little more bassy. My brother's deaf in one ear, so he would EQ it completely different. And that all also can be customized through AirPods Pro with transparency. So when you're out and about, you can enhance the sounds of people talking, or the sound, like the environmental sounds around you. So you actually hear that better to protect you more when you're walking around outside. And there's so many amazing things coming. The alert, you can set your iPhone to alert you if there's a smoke alarm going off, or if someone rings a doorbell, or if there's a siren going by outside. This is another accessibility feature, but it also can be helpful, you know, for people just, you know, with everyday life stuff that don't have accessibility needs, but it's just a benefit anyway. So lots and lots of good things coming.
We're going to take a little break. When we come back, I do want to talk about some really interesting, already the new privacy features in iOS 14 have busted a number of apps for doing really bad stuff. And I have to say, I'm very excited about the privacy features. And then I'll find something that has nothing to do with Apple. Just just to, by now, if you don't like Apple, you stop listening. So I just have to assume everybody listening wants to hear more about Apple, but we'll find some other stories as well. Great panel, really fun. And I do think, and the reason we're devoting so much time to this, these are very important announcements, and not just for Mac users, but this is going to change computing as we know it, I think. One of the things Apple's doing is changing the password space. They're going to add some interesting password features. The good news is you still will want LastPass, especially if you're a business. We're coming to you from the LastPass studios. I've been using LastPass since it came out more than 10 years ago. We started using LastPass at Twit, the enterprise version, several years ago because it's really important. You know, I know how to protect my passwords. I don't reuse passwords. My password is not my dog's middle name and my birth date. It's my dog's first name and birthday. No. I use good, long, strong, random passwords. But your employees maybe not. And the problem is your employees have access to stuff. The keys to the kingdom, I mean, your bank accounts, your databases, your customer records, they're logging into them. You want to make sure they have the same great password practices you do. And that's LastPass. But it's more than just passwords. It's the best enterprise-grade password management out there. It ensures oversight of shadow IT. You've got enforceable policies across all password-protected accounts. For instance, we require our staff use two-factor authentication. LastPass supports it in every way possible. But they do more. They also have multi-factor, which I love. Yes, they use biometrics like fingerprint and face ID. But they also use contextual factors like, you know, geolocation or IP address. And all of this is designed to make sure that the person using your resources is the person authorized to using them. But there's a side effect. It also makes it easier and smoother for employees. LastPass autofills passwords. They don't have to remember them. It'll automatically create passwords. They don't have to generate them. The biometrics, employees love those. They also support single sign-on. In fact, they have more than 1,200 single sign-on apps. That's the easiest of all. You just say yes on your phone and you're in. But what's great for you is that makes you more secure. What's great for employee, it makes it more convenient. And you know what? If security is convenient for employees, they'll do it. And that's really important. Of course, with LastPass, IT always has insight into who has access to what and from where. You're sending employees home. They're working out of the house. You really need to have LastPass. If they're logging into the company VPN, LastPass adds multi-factor to that login, making it that much more secure. And of course, LastPass, as I'm sure you know, but I will reassure you, uses all the best practices. They never own your password. They neither send it nor store the master password. All your data is decrypted on your device. It's never, ever sent anywhere without encryption. That means LastPass has no access to your password vault. And of course, if they don't, neither do the bad guys. Neither does law enforcement. Your stuff is highly protected. It's true trust, no one encryption, AES 256. LastPass works everywhere, including your Apple Watch, including your phone, your computer, every browser. I use it on Linux. It's really great. And in business, it's so important to make it easy for your employees to do the right thing, and that's what LastPass does. LastPass can help make remote work simple and secure. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help your business stay productive and secure no matter what, now more than ever. And you got to have it for business as well as home. LastPass.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting the network, for paying for our studio naming, and just for being a great partner. We've got a LastPass event coming up in the fall. I think I'm going to guess it's probably still going to be remote, but that's actually good news. It means everybody can attend, and we'll fill you in on that as we get closer to the date. So I guess Apple now has these permissions for intents. So developers, when they create iPhone apps, they have to say, well, these are the things we want access to. And Apple will now also not only ask you about that, but also tell you about the privacy policy. They give you a lot more information about what an app is doing. And one of the things it turns out Apple has done in iOS 14 is it tells you when an app is reading your clipboard, which Jeremy Burge, we know well from Emojipedia.com, after he installed iOS 14, he noted that TikTok was grabbing the contents of his clipboard every 1 to 3 keystrokes. So he was getting the Apple slide down, TikTok pasted from Instagram, TikTok pasted from Instagram. He's on Instagram, but TikTok is grabbing what he's typing. Now, maybe that's a bug. Maybe that's TikTok thinking no one would ever know. But I love it that Apple is revealing this kind of stuff. I'm sure they're going to, people are going to be pissed off about it, but good. Good.
It's similar to, you know, finding out that apps are using Bluetooth and you're just, why would this app need Bluetooth out of nowhere? So it's a way for us to really kind of better understand what apps are doing. I never would have imagined that an app would even need access to be copying from the clipboard if it weren't in its own place.
I'm amazed Apple lets it, mm-hmm. but I'm glad they tell us now, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, we can hold these companies accountable to that kind of stuff. Of, you know, like, you better give me a good reason why you're copying my clipboard when I'm, you know, at my banking app or something like that.
Yeah. And there's a lot more, there's privacy controls now around accessing the local network too, which is kind of a big thing where it's like looking for other devices on the network and talking to them, which, you know, can be used legitimately in cases, say you want to Chromecast something, right, to another device. They might need to talk to the outside network for that specifically. But yeah, it's also letting you know if they're trying to like look around and find other devices on your network for some reason. It's also also a positive to be alerted of that.
Now, remember, this is the beta of iOS 14, developer beta of iOS 14. I have not installed any of the betas. I'm so glad you guys are willing to be guinea pigs. It's pretty stable, right? You haven't had any problems?
Well, in Dev 1, don't take that for granted, though. It might completely fall apart.
I put Big Sur on my MacBook Air, and it still won't open email, which I've decided to consider a feature.
That's a feature. Yeah. Hell yeah.
Oh,
I'm installing it now.
We had talked about creating a volume on your Mac so that you can just test it side by side.
Can't
so,
do that.
I don't know if you've heard about this, but don't do it.
I'm
working it out and trying to figure out what's going on and like what I can do to backtrack from where I'm at. But so what happens when you create a volume on your Mac and you install the developer beta of Big Sur, it attaches that update request to your main volume. So right now, my main volume is on Catalina, and it's requesting me to update to Big Sur. I don't have to do it. It just sits there saying, you have an update to Big Sur. And I just leave it alone. But I need my Mac to stay on the Catalina path for updates until Big Sur comes out. So right now, it's just kind of sitting there in limbo. I'm still trying to figure out, like, is there a better way? I don't know how that works, volumes versus partitions. I'm getting feedback from other people that even partitioning your Mac will do the same thing. So don't partition or create a volume on your Mac to do a side-by-side install, because that actually is not working for the dev beta.
And after you told us that's how you were doing it, I saw this on Reddit. Warning, do not install Big Sur on the same APFS container as previous versions. If you do, system software updates can no longer be installed in the previous versions of Mac OS. Also, you get an error on boot stating incompatible disk. So be careful if you're going to do that.
I put it right over Catalina.
You should just install it on top of it.
That one's waiting for the arm replacement.
Yeah.
Also, for $120, you can get a Samsung 500 gig SSD external and install it on that.
That's not the same volume.
I recommend it.
Yeah.
And then actually, Jason, it's a
totally different volume.
That's exactly the right way to do it right now. And frankly, for really, if you really want to make sure that your hard drive is safe, that's the way to do it, is to install it on an external hard drive for sure.
Right. That wouldn't have any of these pitfalls. Also, there's going to be some hell to pay. Maybe Apple will back off on this. I don't know. But among the other permissions, for the first time ever, it's exposing the Apple IDFA, the advertising tracking cookie. Here's the pop-up. You'll see a new user permission. Palabout, which is a made-up app, would like permission to track you across apps and websites owned by other companies. Your data will be used to deliver personalized ads for you. Allow tracking or ask app not to track. Now, that setting's been there before, but the fact that it surfaces it is worrying a lot of people because they think now everybody's going to know.
Yeah, shame. I mean, Apple
wants to tap Apple track me.
Apple's doing a lot of shame, and I love it. The App Store itself, the apps are going to have the ability to, you know, you're basically going to make a privacy declaration on the App Store about what your policies are. And that's going to be another case where the ones who've got good policies are going to be able to trumpet it, and everybody else is going to be like, and, you know, a little bit of shame when people think they're getting away with something is good.
I would, this would be a good thing to try on the election apps. Both the Biden and the Trump campaign have apps they would love for you to install. And I saw an article on decrypt.co that says, the Trump app in particular is gathering a lot of data about people who install it. So that's something, you know, maybe you're such a fan of the president, you don't mind, but it's something to be aware of. They send device ID, call information, Bluetooth pairing. Now, and this also, again, it could be an error, but this is a report in the MIT Technology Review. The reason they're worried about Bluetooth is because it could target you with beacons. It could send you a physical message as you travel through, you know, physical space. It could send you an ad. So there's some concern that that might be the plan, that is, you know, on your way to the polls or whatever, or on your way downtown, you could start getting pop-ups related to where you are. So I think these, you know, for a lot of reasons, these warnings will be good. Apple's not enforcing the privacy policy. Are they even checking to see if you're telling the truth?
I don't know. They can scan some things in your app and do it that way. But
nobody wants to
unclear.
Risk being delisted, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that it's an interesting power move. We'll see how it goes. But yeah. I think it shows that Apple wants to put its customers first when it comes to stuff like this. And that's part of their selling point.
I signed up for Hey.com, and it was interesting that rancorous discussion between Apple and Hey was resolved just before WWDC began. Hey kind of conceded. Basically, Apple said, look, just do something so that the app has some functionality when you install it, and we'll overlook the rest. And so Hey lets you do set up a dummy email account for 2 weeks with a randomly generated address just so the app does something. But it certainly raised a lot of concern about the App Store, about Apple's 30%. The developers of Hey, with a very well-known Basecamp, didn't want Apple to get a third of its $99 a year subscription fee, so they didn't put in app purchases in the app. They said, well, wait, it's just a reader. Why are you charging, you know, why are you preventing? And this is another thing Apple started to do, which I'm not sure I like very much, which is not only they're approved the app, but they won't approve any bug fixes until Hey fixes the problem. And I think that's kind of a problem.
I think they did just walk that back, though. That was one announcement that they made during the week, which is we won't hold up bug fixes anymore because of violations.
Yeah.
And moreover,
because those bug fixes could be security patches.
Exactly. Yeah. And developers will be able to challenge rules, not just rulings like you hold back my app, but like actual guidelines.
That's the big change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Apple will have the ultimate say, but it just is a little bit of a softening. This in the face of EU regulation on this topic, among others. So I think this is the right thing to do.
I'm available for an appointment to the App Supreme Court, by the way. If they need
somebody. You should be a judge, a justice.
I need a gavel. Give me a gavel.
Yes.
App gavel.
Judge Jason Snell, reporting for duty. What were you going to say,
Lori? You even have a good judge name.
Yeah, he does. Judge Jason. Yeah, I'd watch. Olympus, after 84 years making some of the best digital cameras, and before that, my favorite film camera, the OM-1, is finally exiting the camera business. They're selling the Olympus brand to a third party, and all they're going to do is, I guess, make copiers and stuff going forward. So I'm a little sad about that.
Well, maybe that's kind of like what happened with Polaroid, is that you'll see this sort of
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm afraid of.
Wasteland of... No, but Polaroid is back. And even classic Polaroid, which is owned by a different company than owns the digital version of Polaroid, they make fantastic Polaroid cameras with film.
Okay.
Yeah, so maybe it's just going to take, like, somebody who loves Olympus who wants to bring it back. And maybe it's not gone forever. Maybe it's just gone for, 5 to 10 years.
Andy Anako loves his OMDs. I used them for a long time. My wife was a big OMD fan. Scott Bourne, one of our great friends, is a Olympus ambassador. And the Olympus little film cameras, the OM-1, that was one of the greatest cameras of all time. So if nothing else, it's the end of an era. The sad thing is it's one of them activist shareholders, Value Act Capital, putting pressure on Olympus, forcing them to sell. I guess they hadn't made much money in cameras for a long time. In 2007, what happened in 2007 that might have changed the market? Digital cameras were a $3 billion a year business for Olympus.
Wow.
2007, something happened because after that...
coincidence.
That's a complete coincidence. Revenues had dropped even further thanks to coronavirus. That's too bad, but that happens sometimes. Finally, we'll wrap it up because it's been a long show and it's all been Apple, but I'm throwing in this stuff just so you don't feel bad, non-Apple users. Finally, our long...
You should have done it at the beginning, not at the end.
I actually considered that. I thought, I could just do a segment of non-Apple stories and then say, okay, go away because the rest of it is Apple. But, I'm not that organized. Finally, our long national nightmare is over. The length of the foot... has been settled.
Whose foot is it?
It's not. did you know?
The king's.
There are two different definitions of what a foot is. And while they don't differ that much, they differ enough.
One's on the end of your leg and one's a measurement. Yeah. There you go.
The international foot is 0.3048 meters. The U.S. survey foot is a different thing. That's 1,200 divided by 3,937th of a meter, which is an irrational number. It goes on and on and on, which is a very bad choice. So surveyors are the ones who really suffer from this. They actually have to check with the state that they're in to see, well, whose foot do you use? In California, we use the U.S. survey foot. In Oregon, they use the international foot.
Huh.
I feel like surveyor's foot is a thing that people died of in Oregon Trail. When
you died of surveyor's foot.
Surveyor's foot. Goner.
So surveyors knew this, apparently, but by the end of June of, 2023, we got to do this slowly.
They have time.
We can't rush this.
So Apple's going to make its processor transition before they make the survey.
Yes.
Wait, is it still a 5-nanometer processor?
Who knows? It's a foot long. Foot long pro. Yeah, check with that foot long Coney dog. It may be.
Oh, man. What is Subway going to do?
Yeah, right.
Oh, man.
Right. Folks, you are great. I apologize to anybody still listening, waiting for news about PCs or Android.
Look, 2 weeks a year, iPhone week and WWDC week.
This is a big week.
Apple really takes it over. And then, of course, we never hear from Apple outside of those 2 weeks.
Well,
so,
I expect actually it's going to get kind of quiet, isn't it, for a while Apple works in secret on its transition. And then the next big news will be when the new iPhone and perhaps new MacBook 13 are announced. But it's not going to be much to say. So we'll be talking
obsessively. I don't know. Think about this, though, because there's all these rumors that there was hardware coming to WWDC. Apple could any day now just say Apple tags are out and AirPods Studio are out.
No, that's a good point. They have all this stuff they didn't announce.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
They might wait, but it's possible that they'll just decide one day that they're going to put out a press release and we have to scamper to try to figure out what's going on.
Karsten says, I missed the most important story of the week. You be the judge. Microsoft has decided to kill Mixer.
Well,
is there a, I don't know, a cricket sound effect to play?
We were on Mixer, which was Microsoft's gaming service. Actually, you know who's upset is Ninja. Well, maybe not. Actually, a Ninja might be thrilled. Ninja and who is the other guy that moved from Twitch to Microsoft for a big payment? Are Ninja and Shroud and other top streamers, actually, they're probably really happy because they can collect their money and now they go back to Twitch. Mm-hmm. Get this. This is how valuable Ninja is. Tyler Blevins, who is a gamer best known, I think, for Fortnite, he left Twitch late in August last year for $20 to $30 million contract. Not only did Microsoft buy off the contract, they paid him a bonus to say bye-bye. Bye-bye. And Shroud...
Do you remember when you were a little kid and thought, gee, I wish I could play video games for a living?
Who knew? Who knew?
Not only can you do it for a living, but you can be a multimillionaire at it.
Jeez Louise. Shroud and Ninja and King Gothalion, or is it Gothalion? I don't know. Will be released from their contracts as Mixer says bye-bye. They're going to give the Mixer assets to Facebook Gaming. We were streamed on Mixer, but I guess we won't be. They didn't offer me anything. You guys are great. Thank you so much, Dave. Dave isn't here. Dave's not here, man.
Dave's not here, man.
Dave's not here, man. Dan Morin, great to have you on sixcolors.com. Which of your many children do you want to plug?
I'll plug my most recent book, which is The Aleph Extraction, which is the most recent book in my Galactic Cold War series. It's available at Amazon or your local independent bookstore. I always recommend supporting your local independent bookstore. Any other fine bookstore.
Should I start with Pilot Error? Where should I start in that?
I would start with the Bayern Agenda, which is the one that came out last year. Start with that. It's a nice, easy entry point.
That'll get me set up, and then I can get to the Aleph Extraction, the new one, the Bayern Agenda, the Galactic Cold War Saga. I'm so excited. I know a celebrity. That's exciting.
Me too.
Yeah, Dan Morin. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Jason Snell. Always a pleasure. I miss you. I really do miss seeing you and your smiling face. We used to see a lot of you around here because you're just down the road a piece. But now I think Marin's locking you back down, aren't they? They're locking you
in. Yeah, well, I work in my garage, so I'm pretty much locked down all the time. Like it's not that different.
Like I said, we've been planning this for 15 years. We are ready. Mm-hmm. No change at all. Always a pleasure, Jason. Sixcolors.com.
Yep.
The Incomparable. What of your many children would you like to plug?
I would say Six Colors and The Incomparable for podcasts. And I do a podcast with Mike Hurley called Upgrade on Relay FM. That is my sort of weekly tech podcast. If people want to check that out.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being here. You and your lava lamp. You didn't turn it on.
It's on.
Is it on?
It's glowing.
Oh, yeah. There's a blob. It's moving very slowly.
In fact, we're done, so I'm going to turn it off.
It takes a... fancy. Either he has a switch under his desk, or he's got some sort of...
Is that HomeKit compatible?
Some sort of...
It is.
Where do you get a HomeKit compatible lava lamp?
It's a smart switch, yeah.
Oh, I get it. You know, I was very disappointed when I found out you have to turn those on like an hour ahead of time before the lava starts flowing. It's like...
It's true.
Way before the party starts.
Way before that. I learned that, right? The party was over and the lava was still stuck. I should have asked Lori Gill at imore.com, managing editor over there, regular on Mac Break Weekly. Have we talked you out or will you come back Tuesday?
Oh, no, I'm not coming back Tuesday.
Oh, you got the day off?
I'm taking that
You're
day off.
Rotating out? Good. Yeah. Good. You got to speak your piece. Yeah. Well, we will see you a week from Tuesday then.
Yes.
Have a happy 4th of July, everybody. Independence Day is next Saturday, but we will be back a week from today on the July 5th with another, I hope, more thrilling and gripping edition for those of you who ate Apple of this week in tech. Do I do this every year, Jason? I bet I do. I apologize.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. I guess I should have known. I should have expected this.
You could warn people the week ahead of time. Next week, we're going to talk about Apple. If you don't like it,
honestly, I knew that, you know, we would be talking about Apple, WWDC. I didn't really anticipate, in hindsight, I should have known what a big deal this transition to Apple Silicon is. I think it's really fascinating. I even think what they're doing on iPhone and iPad. We didn't mention Scribble on iPad OS. Mm. Bring the Newton back, baby. but there's a lot. There's a lot. But we'll talk about it again on Tuesday. iOS today on Tuesday as well. We do Twit, This Week in Tech, our show, the one you just watched, the one you just slept through. We do this.
Wake up.
Hello. I'm still here. What? Is 2020 over yet? Nope. Go back to sleep. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday afternoon about, I'd say, you know, it varies, about 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. You can watch or listen live. Our live stream is at twit.tv/live. You can also pick up on-demand versions at the website, twit.tv. It's on YouTube. But my favorite way for you to get it is to subscribe. Get your favorite podcast application and search for Twit. Find it, subscribe, and you'll get it every Sunday night the minute it's available for your Monday morning commute from the refrigerator to the couch. At that rate, it'll take you a year to listen to the show. Thanks, Lori. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Dan. Thank you all for listening. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye.